Sam Cedar, where every day is Casual Friday. That means Monday is Casual Monday. Tuesday, Casual Tuesday. Wednesday, Casual Hump Day. Thursday, Casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, Casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, June 17th, 2022. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the proprietor of the blog Hullabaloo, columnist at Salon.com, Heather Digby Parton. Also on the program today, proprietor, co-host of This Is Revolution, Jason Miles, will be with us. Meanwhile, January 6th hearings show Trump's power grab and insurrection fully planned and known to be illegal. Meanwhile, that same January 6th commission has emails showing Ginny Thomas conspired with Trump's coup lawyer. I wouldn't worry about it. The Senate Armed Forces Committee has just passed, and it has to go to the full Senate and the House, but a $45 billion extra to add to the White House Pentagon budget ask. $847 billion for our military. Gun legislation is now snagged by the definition of a boyfriend or intimate partner. This as an Alabama church shooting kills two, injures one. In other legislative news, Joe Manchin supposedly working on a climate and tax reform bill. And the COVID funding completely quashed by Republicans. White House is bracing for a Roe v. Wade ruling, starting to look at some executive actions it can take to mitigate this ban. Spoiler alert, not much. Julian Assange's extradition approved by a British judge. Assange to appeal. And the sad story of Mike Lindell getting canceled again. As Lauren Boebert, outraged by the scandalous accusations that she was a call girl. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is Friday. As you know, Casual Friday. As you can see, I'm wearing a soft-collared shirt. Emma is so casual, she's not even here. Her casuality has basically made her disappear. She's not here. She will be back on Monday. You are in safe hands. Don't panic. Do not panic. End of the week, and we'll be talking to Heather in a bit, and we're going to be talking about the January 6th hearings, because apparently nobody else is on some level. And it is sort of, at once it makes sense, and another way it's sort of stunning, and it sort of depends on what your perspective is. We will get into that more. But we thought we would start with a lighter part of the hearings. That, of course, everyone loves it when Donald Trump craps on Mike Pence. We know that they have had an irreparable falling out with each other. It really does raise the question of, like, who would Donald Trump pick to be his VP if Pence runs? Now, this is, and please do not misinterpret anything I'm saying. As far as I'm concerned, I would put Mike Pence in a jail at the in the deepest recesses of the planet. And I would put him there with the rest of the Republican Party. And maybe I would put Lynn Cheney in a jail that was just, you know, slightly less close to
just the center
of the earth.
Just right above theirs, but close by.
Exactly. I would put her cell the furthest away from the center of the earth. Let's put it that way, relatively speaking. But they would all be within fairly close proximity of the center of the earth. Let me just put it that way. But Pence brought a lot to the Trump ticket. Understand that. He motivated the God Squad to come out and vote for a guy like Donald Trump. Now, they don't care that he's a boob. You know, they don't care that they know he's lying about his long-held belief that, you know, there shouldn't be abortions except for all of the mistresses I paid to have abortions. They don't care about that stuff. They cared about what he would do for them. And Mike Pence was the guy who was essentially the collateral. He was the one who secured the promise that Donald Trump would deliver for the Christian theocrats in this country. And with his alienation from Donald Trump, it'll be interesting to see who they trot out to make that argument again, because they cannot win without those people. They cannot win without those people. George Bush knew it. Donald Trump knows it. In fact, I would argue Mitt Romney and John McCain found out the hard way. But here is Donald Trump furious with Mike Pence because Mike Pence would not go along with the insurrection strategy. And it is, you'll hear it from a couple of the witnesses yesterday.
Yeah, beat it with something like that. Yeah. You're not tough enough to make the call.
It was a different tone than I'd heard him take with the vice president before.
Did Ms. Trump share with you any more details about what had happened or any details about what had happened in the Oval Office that morning?
That her dad had just had an upsetting conversation with the vice president.
Do you recall anything about her demeanor, either during the meeting or when you encountered her in Dan Scavino's office?
I don't remember specifically. I mean, I think she was uncomfortable over the fact that there was obviously that type of interaction between the two of them.
Something to the effect, this is, the wording's wrong. I made the wrong decision 4 or 5 years ago.
And the word that she relayed to you that the president called the vice president, I apologize for being impolite, but do you remember what she said her father called him?
The P word.
What is the P word?
I don't know. I've never said that word in my life before.
Pence. Was it the president? Does he think he's the president? He's a president. Maybe it was that.
You're not the president, Mike. I am.
Why don't we have some possible suggestions as to what that P word might have been?
I think he called him a pussy.
I was going to have you play the audio.
Oh, okay.
Have the president himself.
Spoiler alert.
Let's play a little bit of that audio because and play the Tic Tac part too. That's better.
There's one bit that Vox put in where he's talking about respecting women that they just cut in. So just excuse that bit.
Jeez, your girl's hot as shit in the purple.
Whoa.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes, Nadal the score.
Whoa.
Oh, my man.
Wait, that's look Billy Bush acting like literally like a junior high school.
Yeah, that's it. With the gold. I got to use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her.
There is nobody that has more respect for women than I do.
You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the pussy.
I honestly, it is so, it's almost like Billy Bush's laughter in this is almost worse than Trump. I mean, even arguably is.
Well, because that's the sort of thing that makes it safe to have a culture like this.
Yes, just some, suck-up, just loser suck-up, absolutely no principles, nothing, just so naked in his ambition that he's going to sit there and let this guy. And frankly, look, you know, I've heard talk like this. I was in junior high. I was once 12. I was 12 in the 80s or whatever it was. I guess it was in the 70s. I was 12. So I've heard talk like this. But even like, I don't know, even my friends, like it wasn't even my friends. Like it was just sort of like, are you the mentality to talk like that? Now I could see, you know, saying Pence is a P word. He won't, let me take over the government after the election.
I made a horrible choice 5 years ago.
What a wimp. He won't let me do an insurrection. Come on. But you know what? Here's the thing. Getting aside from the sort of the puerile interest in the word, like this is the way Republicans look at power. This is the way they look at our government. There is no question of like, it's the right thing. It's the wrong thing. I understand why he's deliberating.
Let me go to do some law research.
Yes, this is really, I understand there's a lot of questions and
I'm going to hit the books.
But at the end of the day, the reason why so many of them signed on to this insurrection is just because it was there. It was there and they thought they could get away with it. And here's some news for you. They still think they can get away with it. This isn't like one of those TV episodes of Batman where they come up or I don't know, I guess Bond, where the villain comes up with this like Rube Goldberg contraption to kill Batman or Bond. And when it doesn't work that one time, they give it, he must be impossible to kill. No, they're going to refine this. And they're going to make sure that the next time when I sit down and I ask someone who's of my vice president, I'm going to find out, I'm going to do the P word test. How much of a P word are you? Do you need the lawyers to tell you it's okay? You know, they're all going to be like Bill Barr. And Bill Barr was like, if we can get away with it, let's do it. And Bill Barr just made the assessment at the time, like, I don't think we can get away with it. But Bill Barr wasn't on the, you know, probably in the chain of command of like, well, this doesn't have to do with you now, Bill, because we're moving it over to where we can technically do these things because people can vote any way they want. We control the army. And, you know, we'll get into this with Digby, but there is a sense going across the spectrum on the far left, in the to the extent that we have in this country, the left, the nominal left, I think there is probably, you know, some subsection of liberal Democrats who are paying attention to this, but I think it's somewhat limited. And then as you move to the right, all these people coming from, understand, 40%, 35% of this country lives in areas where they look around and everyone voted for Trump. Everyone voted for Trump. How is it possible? And we've seen like focus groups like this too. Everybody voted for Trump. How is it possible that Joe Biden won? They believe the election was stolen. So that part of the project, they don't need to work on that. They know how to get a rump, but a sizable one of the country to believe their actions are justified. And now they just got to work on half a dozen key positions, if that, to do this next time. And the way they're bolstering those half a dozen key positions is all around the country, they're replacing election officials with them. They've done it in Michigan. They've done it in state after state after state. And for the lot, you know, there's just a huge amount of people who don't take it seriously. And if you listen to foreign press, you listen to the BBC or you listen to, I'm saying English speaking because I don't speak any other languages, and you start to hear them talk about it, you start to get a little bit more freaked out. But we're going to talk more about that with Heather. In the meantime, word from our sponsor. How do I get to sleep at night, particularly these days? Sunset Lake Sabade. SunsetLakeSabade.com. Why do I say those three letters that way? Because of the algorithm. You want 20% off? Use the coupon code LEFTISBEST. They chose it because they're longtime fans of the show. Their products are awesome. You know, and marijuana is legal now in New York State. They're starting to build up the legislation. But, you know, I listen on the radio and they have like a station I listen to has like a lot of CBD advertising and this and that. And they have like a marijuana minute. And I heard the other day, it was like, you know, one of the, on this marijuana minute, like, you know, no matter what you buy, you need to make sure that what you buy is third party tested so that they're, because a lot of this stuff is completely unregulated and they can put all sorts of garbage in their CBD. They can grow it. You don't know what it is. They can treat it with pesticides. Sunset Lake CBD. They use organic fertilizer. They do not use pesticides. They use integrated pest management. You can go to their website and you can see all the third-party testing and know exactly what is in there in terms of what you consume. And you should educate yourself. On top of that, their products have been incredibly helpful to me. They have dealt with, it's meant for your muscles, but the Arnica CBD rub salve has been great for my eczema, but it's great for muscles. The tincture has been putting me to sleep for a long time, although now I switch back and forth between the melatonin gummies that they have. They also have sour CBD gummies. They have kief. They have flour. They have CBD-infused fudge and coffee. It's a great weekend brew, and it's also a great little dessert afterwards, too. Have a little dinner party. Everybody wants to relax a little bit. You don't want to get too into your head. SunsetLakeSabade.com. They're also movement partners. They've done all sorts of great things from raising money for the Innocence Project to supporting union strike funds. SunsetLakeSabade.com. 20% off. Left is best. Check it out. You will not be disappointed at all. Also, today's program sponsored by Shopify. If you run a business, you want to supercharge your knowledge of your sales, you want to supercharge your success, you can do it with Shopify. It's the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Shopify gives entrepreneurs the resources once reserved for big businesses. So it doesn't matter if you're an upstart or a startup or an established business, you can sell everywhere and synchronize your online and in-person sales, effortlessly stay informed. Are the Majority Report Leftist Best shirts selling the best? Or are the baseball shirts selling the best? This is how you order things. Now, this is obviously our merch business is not terribly sophisticated, but Shopify powers our store and does it amazingly well. So it doesn't matter. They power millions of businesses. Doesn't matter if it's your first sale. Doesn't matter if you're full on. Small or big, you can reach customers online and across social networks with an ever-growing suite of channel integrations and apps. Includes Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Pinterest, and more. Plus, you gain insights, like I say, as you grow with detailed reporting of conversion rates, profit margins, and beyond. It's more than a store. Shopify grows with you. This is possibility. It is powered by Shopify. It has been a huge help for us. Super easy for us to set it up. And it gives us, you know, all the data we need, but also if we ever were to go full on into a merch thing, integrate our live show sales with our online sales, we'd have the ability to do it. Go to Shopify.com/majority, all lowercase, for a free 14-day trial and get full access to Shopify's entire suite of features. Grow your business with Shopify today. Go to Shopify.com/majority right now, Shopify. .com/majority. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and when we do, when we return, we will have Heather Parton, or Digby, and Digby, both of them. We'll be right back. We are back, ladies and gentlemen. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out for today. Joining us via the ping is the person who inspired this little ditty.
Are you ready for some pee-pee? Yeah. Are you ready for some pee-pee? Yeah.
All right, that's we'll bring that down. You know, we were just saying before you came on, Heather, I feel like we have played that song during both the good times and the bad times. Yeah. You know, when I welcomed you and I said we'll talk about the January 6th hearings and then the general crap show malaise that a lot of people are feeling, and I realized as those words were coming out of my mouth, like, I've said those a lot of times over the past 6 years. We did determine that we did have like a 7-month period in 2021 where we were feeling a little bit hopeful, maybe 8-month period between the TARP rescue bill and the failure of the Build Back Better. Hey, nice to see you.
Yeah, you too. And here we are, back where we started.
Yes. Well, let's talk about the January 6th, because I've made just two observations over just the past week. One was, like, if you listen to any of foreign news, like BBC, they're just shocked at the stuff that's coming out from these hearings. They're shocked by it. And I juxtapose that with my morning radio station listen to that plays to a sort of like center left type of audience. They're stationed up in Woodstock. And, but I listen, they have like a bottom and top of the hour AP news. And at the bottom of the hour, when it's a little bit shorter, their lead story was not January 6th. It was the fact that Biden's spokesperson is not going to give out information when he tests negative every time. They're not going to announce his testing negative every time, just only if they test positive. And which, of course, I wasn't even aware was their policy to begin with. And okay, mildly interesting. They're trying to, you know, get past COVID, despite the fact that COVID still exists. But nothing about January 6th. Nothing. Nothing about Ginny Thomas. None of it. So the foreign press is like, what the hell is going on? And the U.S. press is like, meh, 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 meh. And I think that reflects Americans' perspective, too.
It's so interesting that you bring that up, because just last night I was watching the BBC. I just tuned in to see, and I got the same impression. They're just going, oh my God, did you see what's going on over there? Look at these hearings. And you had this, you know, this revelations about how they knew it was illegal, and Donald Trump knows very well that the election wasn't stolen, and on and on and on. And it, I mean, really shocking. Now, the truth is that they don't probably have not been following the details as it came dribbling out in the press over the last year and a half or so. But nonetheless, most Americans haven't either.
No.
You know, I mean, that's just that people like us that have been following every nuance of every Maggie Haberman story. I mean, most people didn't care about any of that stuff. Well, it shouldn't say they didn't care. It just that, you know, there's a lot of news out there, and sometimes they heard things and sometimes they didn't. So putting it together into this format is very important to establish specifically what was said. And yet the press, because they know all of that and they've heard most of this stuff before, although frankly, there is some new stuff, they're acting as though it's, you know, it's all old news, which I always knew was going to be a problem, because that is just a, you know, that's a reflexive response on the part of the press to anything like this. And this time it's particularly important that they not do that. And you know, I got to give cable news some credit. I mean, CNN and MSNBC, they've been covering them pretty seriously and been doing, you know, good coverage. The networks did show the first hearing, and they got pretty good ratings for something like that. But that, you're right, there's this sort of sense like, well, this here, you know, this happened, if they reported at all. But really, gas prices, look at this gas station over here that has this price on it. Can you believe it? And, you know, people are having trouble doing this, that, and the other. I mean, it's a gloom and doom scroll of a news cycle over and over again. And of course, January 6th is part of that. But what's important about January 6th is that it is a fundamental structural threat. And I don't think that people really have yet come to understand just what that is. And I don't think that the media is making that very clear. Maybe they can't, but it's like that radio station you're mentioning. That's just a local, you know, like a right. radio station, right? They could do that. They could at least put it into the news, into the bottom of the news, the top of the news that they're talking about. They could just mention it. And I don't think that, I think that's part of where the problem is coming.
Well, they buy the package from the AP. They buy the package from the AP. The AP sends it, and that's the morning news. And there is, and I wonder if, like, you know, on some level, the problem is that there, the, you know, again, it would be nice if we could rely on the press to be this sort of like, genuine source of you know, being able to be the arbiters of these things, mm-hmm. but they're not, and we know this is a fact. Like, I mean, this is you know, this came up even when I had my tweet about Roman Polanski, mm-hmm. when I was like, yes, I understand the word rape is in that tweet, and you know, mention of my daughter, but also the words mise en scène. And, you know, Roman Polanski, this is in the context of Roman Polanski, people wanting to allow him to come in. And the bottom line is, like, news organizations, and I get fired over it and then rehired over it. But my biggest complaint was, like, news organizations need to be able to sort of make an assessment here. They're not an algorithm. They right, know right. the context in which I said that. They know what satire is. It's not just like a series of words that you can word search. And they need to make, and they did ultimately in my case, but they could barely do that. And it was pretty low hanging fruit. So it is the obligation of the Democrats to sort of like figure out how they make this compelling. And I think, like, you know, doing a primetime thing and the way they've done this has been fairly good. But the problem is who the villains are here is so nebulous. You can't say that Donald Trump, because if it was just Donald Trump, it wouldn't be an issue. But there were senators, there were congresspeople. It's clear there's a Supreme Court justice, you know, within a sort of like, you know, close proximity that were involved in this. And if you either say as a class of people, as a group of people, they're bad or you don't. And we've been getting mixed messages from the Democratic leadership. It's in prior to the 2020 even. Right?
Well, absolutely. Well, right now you've got, you know, look at the good man, John Cornyn, who's just working his darndest to get that gun bill passed and then split screen over here. And you have, oh, and by the way, the Republicans staged an insurrection. And by the way, it was the Republicans, right? I mean, one of the things we haven't just seen in the hearings yet, and I don't think we're going to, which is really unfortunate. You know, we just found out that all this, that everybody knew this stuff was illegal, right? I mean, the president knew it was illegal. The lawyers knew it was illegal. Everybody in the White House knew it was illegal. The Department of Justice knew it was illegal. And yet the same thing kept happening, right? They had these lawyers coming over and over again, kind of pressing the case. And we've got to get Mike Pence to do this thing. Okay, that's fine. But you know who else knew it was illegal? People like Mike Lee and Lindsey Graham, who were looking at the same reports and who were taught, or Jim Jordan, who was on the horn with the president every 5 minutes. There was a whole group of people within the Congress who knew exactly what was going on, and not one of them said a word about it. They are equally culpable to John Eastman, as far as I'm concerned. They knew what John Eastman was doing, and they didn't say anything. In fact, they looked at him and went, oh, this really doesn't make too much sense to me. And then they just put the paper down. Well, you know, that's not, it was an attempted coup. And they just went, oh, well, you know, never mind. There were all kinds of things that were going on during that period. Like, you know, Chuck Grassley, for some reason, thought he was going to be, you know, actually opening the votes that day instead of Mike Pence. And everybody's going, what? You know, what are you talking about? Well, it turns out, you know, that was kind of a backup plan, wasn't it? And Grassley knew about it. Now they're saying, oh, well, good old Chuck. He didn't know what he was saying. But of course he did. And so did everybody around him. So you're absolutely right. This is not just about Donald Trump. It isn't just about his crazy cadre of lawyers that were pushing this thing. And it's also, by the way, and, you know, we can get into the more the substance of what's come out at the hearings. But yesterday's hearing was about Mike Pence. Great. You know, that's a big part of the story. I was anxious to hear it. I thought that a lot of the testimony was really good, very informative and very interesting. But Mike Pence is not a hero. Mike Pence, on the day of the insurrection, you know, behaved physically courageously in the fact that he didn't run screaming from the room, help me, get me out of here, okay? He did say that he wanted to stay in the building, which made sense because he's saying, you know, when this thing is cleared out, we're going to come back to work and I'm going to fulfill my duty here. All good. That's a patriotic thing to do. He did the right thing. Great. Good for him. But that was the first moment that he did anything that was truly courageous in this. He knew what was going on since November when Trump was, you know, going on, when they started to plot this thing. He was intimately knowledgeable about what they were plotting and what they were trying to do. And he never said a word. And even all the way up to January 5th, the night before the insurrection, the New York Times reported that he had one of those meetings with Trump where everybody's screaming and yelling and you've got, you know, you're not going to be my friend anymore or whatever the hell it was. You know, Pence was trying to find a middle ground, right? He's going, well, I can't really do this, but maybe I could say something about how the election was stolen. Would that be okay? You know, he's going, you know, he's supposedly, yesterday they said he was steely and determined whenever he was questioned about what he was going to do. No, he was not. He was running off to Dan Quayle, of all people, and saying, can I do this? Would it be okay if I actually do this thing? And it took Dan Quayle to tell him, no, Mike, you can't do it. So no, he was not steely and determined. He was just one of the Trumpers who at the end of the day did the right thing. But boy, did it take a lot.
And let's be clear, let's just spend a moment. It's speculation. But when Mike Pence calls Dan Quayle and says, here's my situation, can I do this? It's not, can I do this? Dan Quayle says, no, it would be the wrong thing to do. The conversation is, you have to weigh the value in you putting this on the line to make Trump president. Because the alternative is, you're set up pretty well to run again in 2024, Mike. You're a young man. It's all ahead of you. You need to make a political calculation. This is the same calculation that Bill Barr made.
Yep.
When he quit 2 months later, he's like, okay, the ship is going down And the ship has a big hole in it, and it's taking on water. And Mike Pence isn't saying, is it the right thing or wrong thing for me to do to try and patch up this ship? It is Mike Pence saying, do I have a better shot at getting my own ship than fixing this one? That's the calculation that's being made. People should be aware of that. And I would argue that Liz Cheney is making the exact same calculation.
I agree.
And, you know, she took a position out here and thought that the rest of the party would be there. When she found that the rest of the party wasn't going to be there, she realized, like, I'm too far gone. I need to commit to this. And you know, I'm young, down the road, I could be all right. I mean, let's remember, this is the same woman who threw her sister under the bus in coming out against marriage equality. I mean, specifically through her own sister, her ambition knows no bounds. I'm sure the same with Mike Pence, too. And so people need to be aware of this. And so it's not like the Democrats don't know this. They're all just equally as ambitious, except for they're just not good at understanding and taking a position and saying, like, you cannot get nuanced with, like, there's good Republicans, there's bad Republicans, there's MAGA, but then there's Uber. What did they come up with? Uber MAGA? Like, when you've got to slice this thinly for the voting population between MAGA and Uber MAGA and Republican, like, you've got a real problem, because like what kind of political messaging is this? It's just insane. Here is, let's play some clips here, and I want you to talk about this. Mike Pence went to former Judge Michael Luttig for advice on these election results. Here is that judge talking about his conversations.
And his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy. That's not because of what happened on January 6th. It's because to this very day, the former president, his allies and supporters pledge that in the presidential election of 2024, if the former president or his anointed successor as the Republican Party presidential candidate were to lose that election, that they would attempt to overturn that 2024 election in the same way that they attempted to overturn the 2020 election, but succeed in 2024 where they failed in 2020. I don't speak those words lightly. I would have never spoken those words ever in my life, except that's what the former president and his allies are telling us.
And we should just say, you know, Luttig, this is the guy who allowed the U.S. government to hold Jose Padilla for, like, without charges. This is a guy who was, like, supposedly threatening to blow up his building with a gas leak, supposedly. And people can Google Jose Padilla and see the pictures of him, like, in a, almost like in a sensory deprivation wear as he's being led into prison. He later was like, I can't believe the Bush administration went further than this and tried to negate the whole thing and then went to work for Boeing. So this is no, you know, this is no screaming lefty. This is somebody who is like basically saying, like, I can see the strategy here. And to be clear, this is one of the guys who advised Mike Pence on refusing to overturn the election. And also to be clear, Pence is going around and getting advice from a lot of different people. It's almost as if he's shopping around to find somebody who's going to tell him how he can get away with it. Exactly. Rather than, I shouldn't do it. How many times do you need different people to tell you, you shouldn't do this?
Well, you're right. To me, I don't know why he needed to ask anybody. I mean, to me, anyone with a normal sense of decency and understanding of how the world works would have just said, no, you know, sorry, you know, Donnie, I'm not doing it. That's ridiculous. We're not going to overturn an election. No. And of course, knowing Donald Trump, he had to know that this was more or less just an ego temper tantrum, sore loserism, where Trump was just refusing to accept his loss. And instead, you know, Pence went around, you know, kind of asking, you know, gee, you know, you're absolutely right. I think he was looking for somebody to give him a good reason to do it, because why else would you do it? Anybody else would have just said no. And Luttig, I think.
Let me just add one more thing about that point. It's not like he was going around and saying, hey, Luttig, what can I do legally to do exactly what is pro forma? Like, it's not like he was looking. I just want to be clear on what these conversations are, because they're being characterized as if he needs advice about something. And doing what he did, which is nothing out of the ordinary, just hold a pro forma, you know, for almost like show vote, essentially. There's nothing clever about that. You don't need anybody's advice for that. You're only going around looking for advice on how do I not do that. How do I help Trump? Is there a way for me to help Trump and not expose myself to too much legal liability? Not what's a tricky way for me to get out of this jam with Donald Trump. It's like, just do your job, dude. That's it. You don't have to go to 12 different people. And we only know the ones that are helping him now, as opposed to the ones that might have been like, might be able to get away with it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, this whole hagiography around Pence is very disturbing to me, because look, the guy's running for president. He would be a nightmare and a disaster. He was not a hero. He did do one right thing. I mean, great. Good for him. He did the thing that every other, you know, vice president has done in American history up until now, and certified the vote with this one pro forma, you know, event. It's a ceremonial thing. He did do that. So that was very heroic of him, and great, you know, thanks a lot, Mike. But, you know, the rest of this idea that he just stood up heroically to Donald Trump and did whatever, you know, give me a break. No, I don't think so. And Luttig, his, you know, testimony was very important in the sense that, you know, one of the things that's going to be held against these hearings is that they are not, quote, bipartisan, right? Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger don't count. They're rhino, you know, turncoats, and they don't, you know, everybody knows that they're just not going to suffice as proper, you know, Republican rebuttals to what's going on. So that's the big, you know, that's going to be the big roadblock for Republicans. Not that I care. I mean, they don't care about this anyway, but nonetheless, that seems to be, you know, as far as establishing credibility, that's a problem. So the committee's doing something very, very skillful, I think, in getting people like Michael Luttig, who is, as you point out, he's the most, the only person they could find more conservative than him would have been to exhume Antonin Scalia's body, right, and prop him up there. There is nobody more conservative than Michael Luttig. And so it carries some weight, just in terms of credibility, maybe only in terms of history. You know, we don't know how this is going to play out. But nonetheless, it's skillful to put people like him and to put Trump's inner circle and Pence's inner circle up there and have them be the testimony. There have been no Democrats testifying about anything. I mean, there was one Capitol Police woman who testified, who was not a partisan Republican. And I mean, these aren't any Republicans. They aren't just, you know, they aren't, they're actually testifying. Now, that doesn't let any of these people off the hook, by the way. But in the same token that we're sitting there talking about Pence, I'm glad they fought this, the coup. I mean, good for them. I mean, it's kind of the least, it's kind of a low bar, isn't it? That we could expect, like, you know, lawyers in the executive branch to not go along with a coup. I mean, thank you, but gee, I wouldn't have thought that would be a question. But nonetheless, they did do it. We'll give them credit for that. But that is what, that is how these hearings have been structured, so that it's all, it you can't call it partisan when Michael Luttig is the witness, right? You can't say that's a bunch of, you know, woke Democrats talking. That's Michael Luttig talking. And there, he, whatever you say about him, that is just not, that's not an accusation you can make about him. So I thought that that was important, and it was mostly important for the fact that he was talking about the future. And, right. You know, even more than he was talking about the past, he sent out that warning, and he's one of the people out there from that side. I mean, there are plenty of us who were sitting there ringing the alarms, you know, night and day about what they're doing out in the states to change the laws and, you know, basically setting up a situation that, that we could, it almost looks inevitable that we're going to have some kind of a contested election in 2024, where they're going to use some of these tactics that they tried in 2020, and we're going to see whether or not they can make it work. A lot depends on what happens this fall if they elect a bunch of secretaries of states and other people who can do that.
And here's the thing that I think people really need to internalize. This apparatus is being set up. It doesn't need Donald Trump. This apparatus is being set up, and it is being set up in the same way that minoritarian rule exists in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania and in North Carolina, where 55% of the vote for Democrats gets you 35% of the representation in the state house. This is being set up as a mechanism for the Republican Party to deal with the fact that there just aren't as many Republicans as there are Democrats in this country. That is, I mean, that's it. It is that simple. Mike Pence may very well be sitting on top of this. Yeah, I don't think he will be, but it's possible. It could be DeSantis. It could be somebody else. Tom Cotton. Sitting atop this construction, with the benefit of knowing, like, this is why it didn't work last time. So the, you know, those people who are sending us the electors in Michigan or in Pennsylvania or Florida, wherever it is, Wisconsin, they're doing the dirty work for us. So by the time it gets to us, we don't have to do the problem that they have isolated is the heavy lifting happened in Washington. And they want the heavy lifting to happen in the states so that when it gets to Washington, like, you know, because their responsibility in Washington was to make 3 + 2 = 4 because they got sent 3. They got sent 2, and we're supposed to just add it, and it's obvious, and come out with the, we don't want to do that. We want you to turn the 3 into a 2 back in your state. So you're just sending us 2 + 2, and we're just doing the pro forma thing. And that's what's happening with the Republican Party, not the Trumpistas. No, it's with the Republican Party. If they cared about it, Mike Pence would be out there right now complaining about what's going on in Michigan. Mitch McConnell would be complaining about it, but they're not. And so people need to be aware of this.
Absolutely. This is this. You want to know, you know, everybody knows that the Republican Party kind of wishes Donald Trump would go away. He's a pain in the ass. He's a problem. He causes nothing but trouble. You know, they have and they have a whole new generation just champing at the bit to take over. You've got Ron DeSantis down there just setting it up just week after week with one culture war issue after another. Right. And so they had, there's a reason why someone like Mitch McConnell, who knows very well that Donald Trump is a disaster as a president, as a party leader, as everything, isn't saying anything about this, that he continues to tacitly support whatever these people are doing. And it's exactly what you just said. And it's so important to understand the party benefits from Trump's big lie. It is benefiting from Trump's insurrection. It is benefiting from this. If it didn't, they would be out yes. there getting rid of the guy because he's not worth it. It's not that they're afraid. I mean, I'm sure they are afraid of their voters. A lot of their voters are, you know, psychos at this point, and they're all, you know, packing heat. But that's not the real motivation. The real motivation for them going along with all this stuff, the, you know, ultra, you know, Uber MAGA stuff, is because that benefits them. It benefits them because they know exactly what you just said, that they are losing demographically. Their party is a minority party, and the only way that they can continue to rule as a minority party is by manipulating the system in these ways that they're doing. And it's exactly right. They passed it off to the states. And by the way, you know, there's a bunch of legal theories that are backing all this stuff up. I would have liked to have heard something from, you know, when maybe we will somewhere down the road, I don't know, about things like the independent legislature doctrine, which is some ridiculous concept out there that says, yeah, the state legislatures can overturn elections if they want to. You know, I think most Americans would go, if they knew about this, would go, what are you talking about?
Right.
You know,
why
are we having elections? What's the point of that if they can just do that? And that's the kind of thing that's also working its way through the legal system. And it's probably going to get up to the Supreme Court, where we have another group up there that understands that their, you know, tribe, that their party is going to benefit from this stuff. So, you know, let's not be naive about why anybody is, you know, why the Republican Party is tacitly backing Trump's play on all this stuff. It's because it works for them too. That's just, you know.
Here is a clip of Mike Pence's, or the former Mike Pence's counsel, Greg Jacob. He's being interviewed by, or I should say questioned by, Representative Pete Aguilar from California. And Jacob is relating what John Eastman related to Mike Pence. John Eastman is essentially Donald Trump's coup lawyer. John Eastman, there are emails that he had to deliver to the committee show that he had been in contact with Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny. And not just in contact, I mean, they were conspiring. I don't know what else to say. Like, they're trying to figure out how they overthrow the election. I should also say John Eastman was also Clarence Thomas's former clerk. So the relationship runs deep here. And here is what Eastman is telling. Here's what Jacob is relating that Eastman was telling Pence prior to January 6th.
Jacob, did Dr. Eastman say whether he would want other vice presidents such as Al Gore after the 2000 election, or Kamala Harris after the 2024 election, to have the power to decide the outcome of the election?
So this was one of the many points that we discussed on January 5th. He had come into that meeting trying to persuade us that there was some validity to his theory. I viewed it as my objective to persuade him to acknowledge he was just wrong. And I thought this had to be one of the most powerful.
Pause it for 1 second. Again, I know we made this point earlier in terms of, like, you know, all of Mike Pence's great, you know, sort of like integrity and whatnot. Mike Pence is under no obligation to meet with John Eastman.
Of course.
But like, and if Greg Jacob, the counsel to the vice president, feels like he needs to convince John, he needs to convince John Eastman he's wrong? No. He needs to convince Pence that John Eastman is wrong. Let's be clear what's going on here. As late as the 5th, Pence is still like, I'm on the fence about this.
Mm-hmm.
And the lawyers around Pence are like, eesh. This reminds me of, like, when there was a story that came out about Governor LePage in Maine. You remember this? Where he kept inviting sovereign citizens to his office, and they were telling him, like, you have the right to assassinate the leader of the Senate in Maine because he's not agreeing with you, and all the power lies with the sheriffs. And LePage's, like, lawyers were all around going, like, we can't let these people in there anymore. Why is John Eastman even getting into the vice president's office 4 months after the election is over? Like, why would Mike Pence even care unless he thought, like,
it's on the table.
It's on the table.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah.
Persuade him to acknowledge he was just wrong. And I thought this had to be one of the most powerful arguments. I mean, John, back in 2000, you weren't jumping up and saying Al Gore had this authority to do that. You would not want Kamala Harris to be able to exercise that kind of authority in 2024 when I hope Republicans will win the election. And I know you hope that too, John. And he said, absolutely. Al Gore did not have a basis to do it in 2000. Kamala Harris shouldn't be able to do it in 2024. But I think you should do it today.
I mean, what if Eastman was sort of adept enough at saying, like, yeah, no, they could have. Well, okay. Well, then, Michael, do it. I mean.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I thought that was just such a great illustration of the entire coup plot that was going on, which, by the way, Mike Pence was aware of. They knew it was illegal. They knew it was unconstitutional. It was just a sheer power play. Sheer power play, just we can do it, but we won't let them do it. And that is just how they operate.
And here again is another example of what I think is the Democrats' failure here. Because the question is, why was John Eastman in that office on January 5th? Like, why was Mike Pence entertaining it? Like, give us a sense, Greg Jacob. Where was Pence at this point? Was he 95% against this? So he's 5% for it. Or was he 20% for it? Or 30% for it? I mean, if your agenda was to get Eastman to admit that he's wrong, why was that important? I mean, how far down the road was Mike Pence on this? Like, how many different people did Mike Pence need to exhibit to him that this is wrong? We know Quayle. We know the Luttig. We now know that you and other attorneys are sitting there trying to make Eastman look like a fool, which doesn't look that hard. Was he still not convinced, even as late as January 5th? Like, I mean, this is the question, but the Democrats have this sort of like problem, and they think that they need to show there are good Republicans.
Yeah.
And this is the problem. Like, there's two things that are going on here with these hearings. One is it's super important to have this on the record historically. Three. It's super important to tell people who actually take this seriously as to like what the outlines of the plan was and figure out how to thwart this in 2024 before it starts rolling.
Right.
But the third thing is you want some political value out of it. You want to explain to the American public there is a malignancy in this party. And in addition to the fact that Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden are out there saying we need to appeal to the good Republicans, in addition to the fact that they're out there trying to message Uber MAGA as opposed to MAGA as opposed to Republican is also muddying the waters. But they're also like trying to protect Pence as a sort of the white knight because they think he's okay. We can beat him. And this is like we're going to create, you know, we're trying to drive a wedge within the Republican Party. It is not working. You right. need to motivate non-Republicans to go out and vote against Republicans. That is the problem with 2022. Ultimately, it's the problem with 2024. But 2022, the dynamic before a word is said is that 2/3 of the Democrats come out to vote and 3/4 of the Republicans that come out to vote. That's just the way it is. And you need to say to all of the people who would vote against Republicans, there's a real reason to do it because they're all bad.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. That's in fact, I think I put up a post yesterday that I think Bernie Sanders had a good op-ed in The Guardian yesterday talking about that, just saying, look, we have to run against Republicans. We have to run against them. They're destroying democracy. They're trying to, they're taking food out of the mouths of children. You know, I mean, they want to, have guns in every school. I mean, this is this idea somehow that you're, simultaneously saying, well, Republicans are okay, but MAGAs aren't okay. But we want to run against Republicans and MAGAs. And, it's confusing. And I think that it does dilute the political value of these hearings. which are, you know, tremendous in my view. I mean, the political value should be overwhelming, and it should be. And, you know, we'll be interested to see if there's any change in polling. So far, there isn't. But over time, maybe if there's some revelations that people finally, you know, glom onto. But the point is that they are. I mean, I understand why they're using Republicans to tell the story. You have to. It's a Republican scandal. There's, you know, Democrats had basically nothing to do with what was going on that day. So you have to do that. But there could be more skillful,
yes,
sort of.
I don't care, you know, if you make
underlying, you know, subtext here of, you know, I mean, like asking Jacob that question would have been very interesting. Asking Jacob, why were you letting John Eastman into the office? What was the point of that? Why didn't you just not take his calls? Why was it necessary to continually be arguing with him? What was the problem there? Why was Mike Pence having second thoughts? You know, and of course,
or
you know,
second thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, they're all going, well, you know, he was steely and determined. You know, well, They could have probed that a little bit, I think, and without, you know, risking the idea of getting cooperation. I mean, you know, I'm not saying that it's necessarily an easy task, but these are, you know, they have skillful lawyers, they have skillful prosecutors, they have, you know, and of course, you know, you want to get Trump. I get that. Trump was the lead on this whole thing. But it is very important, and I'll just come back to the fact that there were people like Mike Lee and Lindsey Graham and Jim Jordan and, you know, a lot of
Ted
people.
Ted Cruz, I mean, all these people. Cotton.
Who were in on this, who understood exactly what was being attempted and attempted to help them and were working with them on accomplishing this. And, you know, that's really an important thing to know. And I don't think that most Americans, even those who are following this, know that. I think they think this was Trump and Rudy and these weirdos. And
well, because they're allowing, you know, the committee is allowing them to make these distinctions. And the question you needed for Jacob is pretty straightforward. You know, like, where was Mike Pence at this moment? Oh, he was totally against it. Then why were you even meeting with Eastman? Why would you waste the vice president's last day in office? Why are you meeting with? I mean, you know, that, like, that's the moment that should be out there. The message that they have failed to convey, which is really the only message that, you know, you can expect the American public to absorb. Republicans bad. Republicans bad. I mean, you know, if people want to dig deeper into it, you're providing all of the, you're providing the receipts. Mm-hmm. But the message at the end of the day has to be Republicans bad. Even if it's like Democrats, not great, maybe not even good, but just not as bad. Like, right. That's it right there. Like, Republicans so bad that they failed to do that. And even just like, all right, let's play this one more clip. I mean, because I would have been fine with like, you know, people like, well, Mike Pence was completely gunning for American democracy. But, you know, I got to say, Greg Jacob seems, you know, like a fairly stand-up guy. I mean, you know what? That's okay. That's okay. Here is Greg Jacob. He's being questioned by the committee counsel, John Wood, on the fact that John Eastman, again, John Eastman conspiring with Ginny Thomas, now it is being revealed, and the committee is questioning whether they're going to bring this up. This goes to the heart of what my complaint is. How do you make this argument and not bring this up? It's absurd. It is nuts. But they want to protect, and they've done this since the day Donald Trump announced. They want to protect a certain segment of Republicans, and it's just...
If I could just add that this goes to something that's very, very important about the coup itself, which I think, and I wrote about it this morning in my piece for Salon, by protecting this Ginni Thomas thing and kind of, you know, refusing to really delve into that as a particular aspect of this coup, it means they would have to ignore something that's come up in the whole Eastman testimony about Eastman. It came up yesterday. Two different people, Jacob and this other guy, Hirschman, who was part of the White House counsel's office, both said that they talked to Eastman about, you know, okay, let's say Pence does this. What happens then, right? That was the big question, one we've all been wondering. Well, what did they think was going to happen after they stole it like that? You know, we were all going to shrug our shoulders and say, yeah, well, I guess that's that and move on. I mean, we did in 2000, so maybe we'd do it again. Maybe that's what they counted on. But the truth is that they knew there was going to be violence. They understood that there was going to be violence. But Eastman's view, which I thought was so interesting yesterday, was that the court was not going to take up the case. He said the court will not take it up under the political involvement doctrine or something, it's called something like that, that they wouldn't touch it because it was too much of a hot potato for the court to get into. They would just leave that alone and sort of say, well, look, the political branches have
you got to work this out.
Work this out themselves. And so Jacob says, well, there's, you know, then it's like a constitutional jump ball was how he described it. He goes, it's a standoff basically, and there's nothing. And the only result of that would end up being violence in the streets. And Eastman said, yes, but that's happened many times in our history when people protected democracy and the republic. So that knowledge that Eastman had, now, did he get it from his good friend Ginni and Clarence, who he'd known since he was a clerk? Did he have some understanding that the court had decided not to take up the case? I don't know, but that's a very salient and important question, I think, that needs to be asked, because what were they planning after and Mike Pence did his job?
We've heard from much reporting that Donald Trump wanted to impose the Insurrection Act.
Absolutely.
And that's what would have happened next. Yep. The Insurrection Act would have been imposed. And one of the things that I think has been a failure of these hearings or remains to be seen. I want to hear from, I know that they interviewed these people earlier, but I want to see on TV the military people being hauled up in front of there, the National Guard, the Capitol Police, and the military, and find out exactly like why the orders, like why there was 15 guards guarding the Capitol that day when it was clear that there was an awareness both with the insurrectionists and the police force that there could be problems. Well, the insurrectionists knew what they were doing. They were scouting. But the police knew, and why there was this slow sort of response. And to the extent they got any orders, it was to protect the protesters. But here is Greg Jacob. Eastman's still working on it on January 7th. Listen to this.
And that the speeches that the majority and minority leaders had been allowed to make also violated the Electoral Count Act because they hadn't been counted against the debate time. And then he implored me, now that we have established that the Electoral Count Act isn't so sacrosanct as you have made it out to be, I implore you one last time, can the Vice President please do what we've been asking him to do these last 2 days, suspend the joint session, send it back to the states.
And we'll show you the text of that email, which Dr. Eastman wrote at 11:44 p.m. on January 6th. So after the attack on the Capitol and after law enforcement had secured the Capitol, he still wrote, as you described, quote, "So now that the precedent has been set that the Electoral Count Act is not quite so sacrosanct as was previously claimed, I implore you to consider one more relatively minor violation and adjourn for 10 days to allow the legislatures to finish their investigations." So even after the attack on the Capitol had been quelled, Dr. Eastman requested, in writing no less, that the Vice President violate the law by delaying the certification and sending the question back to the states. Is that correct, Mr. Jacob?
It is.
Did you eventually share Dr. Eastman's proposal with Vice President Pence?
Not right at that time, because the Vice President was completing the work that it was his duty to do. But a day or two later, back at the White House, I did show him that final email from Mr. Eastman.
And what was Vice President Pence's reaction when you showed him the email where Dr. Eastman, after the attack on the Capitol, still asked that the Vice President delay certification and send it back to the states?
He said, that's rubber room stuff.
I can't help but think, like, if Jacobs wanted to hold that email back a couple of days.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I like to think maybe Pence would have said that's rubber room stuff on that day. But
who knows?
You know, if Jacob is opening that email on the evening of the 6th, right?
Yeah, why?
Well, like, you know, aside from, like, why is he, like, he's opening that email. I imagine he was in close contact with Pence, if not, like, there.
He was with him. Like, no, he was with him that whole day.
Going, like, you can't believe what Eastman's saying now. I don't think Jacob had that level of confidence in Mike Pence to share that email at that time.
Yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought of that, but you're absolutely right.
You know, like,
yeah,
let's
look,
get
yeah,
a load
maybe,
of this
maybe
guy
maybe
that we were taking seriously recently.
Yeah, like, remember 24 hours ago where I was having to, like, make this guy look like he was in a rubber room so that you wouldn't sign on to this? Like what's the rubber room part? 3 days ago, you had this guy in your office, and you took him very, very seriously.
Right. He argued with him for hours. This is so interesting because I really hadn't quite put this together till you bring it up. This idea, you know, the idea that he spent hours with this guy on January 5th. He said he was there. They arguing back and forth with him for hours.
There's no value. There's no value to Mike Pence to convince Eastman that he's wrong here. Right. There's only value to Mike Pence to find out if he can do it because he wanted to do it.
Right.
He was making an assessment.
Yeah.
He was making an assessment. What's the best move for Mike Pence? Is it to, like, you know, sort of let this die and keep my career going 4 years from now? Or is it to, like, become vice president again for another 4 years and then rerun then? Am I going to get away with this? That's what these arguments were about. Am I going to get away with this? And fortunately, I guess, for all of us, Eastman is such a lunatic that only Ginny Thomas and Clarence Thomas are on his wavelength. But
yeah, well, I mean, very interesting. And I think that one of the things that does work against Mike Pence in all of this, that the hearings, and I think it's totally inadvertent. I don't think they're doing this on purpose. But the fact that he was, you know, that he's being sort of portrayed as a big hero, right? I mean, he stood up, he was steeling determined, and he said, you know, no, I will not do it. I shall not do, you know, I shall defend the Constitution or whatever. But the fact is that, you know, Trump was calling him a pussy to his face that day. And then he, you know, did his thing, and he stood up that day and said, you know, he went ahead and counted the votes like it was a big deal. But ever since then, he's acted like exactly what Donald Trump called him. I mean, I hate to say it, but that guy, Mike Pence, is out there being as, you know, worm-like as you can possibly be about this. I mean, if he were truly this hero, he'd be testifying, right? He'd be up there saying,
well,
whatever. Instead, he's kind of walking around going, yeah, well, I'm trying to move on. I you know, we'll never see eye to eye on that day and blah, blah, blah. You know, he's going on and on. And, you know, that's, to me, I think that by portraying him as a hero in that day, by saying that they were trying to murder him, right? They said basically yep. that, you know, Trump was trying to have him murdered. The Proud Boys were there basically saying we were going to take him out if we got to him. He was 40 feet away from the mob, that they were going to tear him limb from limb. And he stood up and he was this big hero. So, but now he's walking around going, well, it's no big deal. And I don't really want to make him move.
To be
forward.
Fair, Mike Pence has always been a worm. And so he's not being more wormy now. He's just maintaining his worminess.
Being himself. You're right.
Exactly. But I just think that there is this message that Mike Pence is no hero. He did the bare minimum is a failure on part of the Democrats to make this political. And let's be honest, this is no one's going to get indicted from this. No one's going to go to jail for this. The argument is in the court of public opinion, period, right, of course. End of story. And so if you do not make it clear who are villains here, who, you know, you don't get extra credit because you realized it's not in my best interest to rob the bank today. I'm going to rob it next week. You don't get extra credit for that. But Heather Parton, as always, a pleasure. Folks should head over to both Salon.com to read what you've been writing about this and over at Hullabaloo to read it as well. Always a pleasure. And we'll do it again soon, of course.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Have a great weekend.
You too. Folks, do we need to take a break to bring in Jason?
Yeah, real quick one, I think.
I'll bring him in now.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and Jason Miles of This Is Revolution will be joining us. We're running a little bit late, but that's all right. We'll see you in just one moment. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland is out for today. She's fine. Joining us is welcoming back to the show, Jason Miles of This Is Revolution podcast. He's got his own soundboard. There you go. Don't hesitate, please. Jason, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's been a long time. I'm excited to be here. This is always a fun time to talk with you, actually, because first of all, I'm always fascinated by your history on the left and in left media, and then also your history in show business, because I wasn't in the film industry, but I was in the music industry. So
we were adjacent. I thought you were going to say something about me being a boomer.
I'm old as well. So what am I going to do? I'm going to fucking shit on you for being old too.
Yeah, I appreciate that. But just to be clear, I'm not a boomer. I'm an Xer. And I just read a piece too that someone sent to me on Twitter. I can't remember who it was, that there was for a brief moment a term, the Jonesers, who were the second half of the boomers. And so the distinction was like, did you, you know, were you Ozzie and Harriet or the Brady Bunch, I think was the distinction in this opinion piece. Hmm. Did you relate to Woodstock, or were you more punk? And like that older, something like from 65, like 55 or 53 to 65 in terms of that last half of the boomers, had a very different experience. But I was born in 66, so I am a Gen Xer, just to be clear.
Yes, you and my co-host, and actually me as well. I'm on the latter end, but yeah, we're all of a certain generation. So.
All right. Well, so let's talk about you put out, I mean, in addition to a great show that you and Pascal do on This Is Revolution, This Is Revolution podcast, you put out these like video essays that are really like, they're like short documentaries that are, you know, or video essays and almost like, I don't know, sort of Adam Curtis-y a little bit. And
I'm inspired by Adam Curtis and my, I guess I could say co-worker, co-partner in some of this stuff, Doug Lane in some of this stuff. And, this last one, the last couple actually kind of drained me mentally. Because there's a lot that goes into them. There's a lot of, and this last one, a lot of conversations went into this one, a lot of conversations with actually Adolph Reed Jr. Because he actually had experience watching Sweet Sweetback. He actually told me a really great story about going to see the film, and on his way to see the film, he had went to some sort of conference about cable television and how it was going to democratize.
Oh my God.
TV.
That's funny. That's really funny. That's really funny. I did not hear that talking point during that time. And so we should just say the name of this video essay is same as it ever was. And what was it? What's the subtitle?
Talking Heads.
Talking Heads.
Oh, okay. Where was that from? Yes. Okay. That is a phrase from Talking Heads. I thought that there was like some subtitle.
Black shit in there? No. It was not as black as you thought it was.
And so you track the development of essentially, I want to say like black cinema, but it's really not. It's also the relationship with the audience and the market, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the idea ultimately is that the concept of black power becomes cultural and not necessarily or just not political over the course of these years that black cinema develops. And, you know, it's a fascinating thing. Like, I remember these periods and didn't necessarily remember them as periods per se. But let's go through that just so that we can set that table and talk about the more themes. But, it starts with, it basically starts in the late 60s, early 70s. And what was interesting is that for me, a white guy, that period, I mean, I was aware of like Dolemite and Sweet Sweet Badass and Putney Swope, you know, that sort of like genre in there a little bit. But for me, when I was a filmmaker, that period was special because that's when like the bottom fell out of the studio business and you got like the Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, like all those movies.
The Maverick filmmaker.
The Maverick
era.
Filmmakers, where like people are like, we don't have any money, so we're just gonna, everything's gonna be a risk.
80% of films that were made in that era were independent. I found
this
that
is
out.
Like the late 60s, early 70s. Yes. Cassavetes is going, you know, is like sort of comes out of that period, but also Bogdanovich and Scorsese and Coppola, they were all born in that.
You
time.
Get the USC guys, right?
Yep.
Lucas comes out of that as well. It's like the new left, right? So you get some of the filmmakers from the new left that come out of that that make those movies like Easy Rider.
Yep.
And then you get this. This resurgence, I kind of want to say resurgence because black film has existed since there was celluloid, but we don't talk about that era. For whatever reason, whenever people go back and talk about black film, they want to start it kind of in this Hattie McDaniel, Shirley Temple dancing with grown ass men, calling her Miss Shirley. And we want to forget this very forgotten era of black cinema. And we also forget that cinema was just different when movie studios controlled the movie houses, the theaters. And when that goes away, coupled with deindustrialization, coupled with white flight, you start to get left with these big movie theaters in urban areas that are having a hard time staying open. And
let me just interject so that people don't. It used to be that studios owned the movie houses, and there were then laws that were passed, Sin Fin laws, that you could not own both ends, both the production and the retail end of it. Now, those were overturned in the 90s. Yeah. Al Franken made a big deal of that, and it changed the television business, and it changed the movie business quite a bit. And it was all part of the Telecommunications Act. But that allowed for competitors within the movie business to create a broad range of movies. But like you say, at one point, it leaves these theaters in a tough jam.
And, you know, couple that with the rise in better television production. When television first comes out, no one knows what to do. So television is just live radio for its first iteration. Once television starts having really good produced shows, well, now people are sitting at home watching television. So there becomes this kind of open range to make whatever you want to make. And post-World War II, there's also a move to have better roles for black people by the NAACP. You know, so that's when we get the rise of Sidney Poitier, Lilies of the Field, To Sir with Love, even movies like The Defiant Ones. So there's black people in cinema winning, as you can say, as some might say, before this era. But it's a certain type. And by the time Sweetback comes out, this is strictly what we would call a hood movie or a movie for the lumpen proletariat. And I'm sorry, there's remodeling.
Don't worry about that.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's interesting is when Sweetback comes to be, he makes that movie on, I think, a $500,000 budget with a big loan getting given to him by Bill Cosby, actually. And this is going to be the movie for Black Power. And I had asked Adolf, I was like, well, when you saw it, were you like, did you feel like this was, we had arrived? And he was like, I had a feeling what was going to come from it was what happened, but I didn't know it was going to be as big as it was.
And this is Melvin Von Peebles, we should say.
Melvin Van Peebles' Sweetback's Badass Song makes $15 million. And what makes that interesting is not just the fact that that was such a good return on investment, was because it was a black movie made for a black audience where black people kept going back to see it. So one of the strategies for these studios to get back into black, I mean, we have to keep in mind, was it Warner Brothers or Paramount is auctioning off the ruby slippers from Wizard of Oz. They're auctioning off parts of their back lots at this moment in time. Like, this is a bad time for studios. They're taking huge losses on these big budget films. So now it's like, okay, here's a strategy. We're going to pick a genre and we're going to cut the budget and we're going to make genre movies and see what happens. Sweet Sweetback shows you, okay, well, these Negro films sure are doing well. Shaft originally was a white dude. He gets replaced with the unknown at the time, Richard Roundtree, and Shaft kills at the box office. Then you get Superfly the next year. And it's like, this is what you want. You're going to get more of it. Pretty much right away, there was pushback from the NAACP, CORE. A lot of the black political class did not like this era.
Because it's depicting, like sort of, I guess, like dysfunction in the ghetto, I guess. And it is that what it is?
I mean, keep in mind, Superfly is about a dude that's a coke dealing pimp.
Right.
That decides that the only way out is by being a coke dealing pimp.
Right.
So these movies are pretty much primed for this neoliberal era that we're going into. And they're pure fantasy, right? It's kind of escapism. It's you're watching super hood characters. This shit isn't real, right? There's nobody like Superfly in real life. There might be pimps in your neighborhood. But this is also the era where we start to see a lot of the Panthers are going to prison. A lot of these big movements that are collective movements are starting to fall by the wayside. And so a lot of cats that had the afros and dashikis and black power fists are putting on pimp coats and they got coke spoons now. So there's definitely a move, right? That this is the way for us to liberate ourselves. And in all of these movies, there's always some sort of like black radical character with a turtleneck and a beret that has failed the people.
Right.
There's even a line in Superfly where Superfly looks at the dude and is like, you failed. I'm going to help us out. Because, you know, you didn't do what you were supposed to do.
This is sort of like the analogy is a little bit sort of like Jerry Rubin leaving the, leaving the yippie movement for the yuppie movement. Like we're right in between like that sort of this is what's happening like in the white version of this on some level. It becomes yuppified, but in the sort of black cinema lineage, it moves at that point. At one point, it becomes like there's enough pushback. Is it that there's enough pushback, or is it just like people get, you know, they've seen enough? Like, they're, you know, everybody was pumping this out, and, you know, what's the next new thing? And the next new thing becomes, really, in many respects, like, again, from independent film, is sort of like Spike Lee's, yes. I guess. She's got to have it. And that was that. When was that? It was that in the 86. And this is like the very beginning of like commercial. This is what was so weird about the 80s. So you've got guys like Cassavetes who are taking the money that they're earning by acting in the Dirty Dozen. And he did this show called Johnny Staccato, which was a show he did for like where he played like back from Korea and he's a PI on TV. It's actually a sort of a fascinating show. And he's taking that money and he's making these independent movies. Mm-hmm. And they never break into the mainstream. They're in like these random houses and that's it. by the time you start getting into the '80s, there is like, and maybe Spike Lee was one of the first ones where it's an independent film, or at least maybe one of the first ones I was aware of. I mean, I guess, you know, you had Easy Rider was sort of like that, but
just
not
the Spider Woman. I mean, there was independent films that were coming out. But as I was doing my research for this, what was fascinating to me to find out about Spike Lee, and I have to say on air, a lot of this research that I was doing, Turay, Adolph's son, also helped lead me in a lot of the right direction for where to look for information about Spike. And what was fascinating about Spike Lee was, unlike Melvin Van Peebles, who, if you really look at his trajectory, made a contrarian film to what the black intelligentsia wanted to see, right? That's all Sweet Sweetback is. And Spike kind of does the same thing in a way with She's Gotta Have It, because he's making his movie, because he's not from the hood at all. There's nothing hood about Spike Lee. And he makes actually his first few movies are very, very black middle class, upper middle class ass films. He's part of black gentrifiers in Fort Greene.
Yep.
So She's Gotta Have It is a black movie, but it only gets a distribution deal when a majority white audience sees a screening of it in San Francisco and gives it the thumbs up.
And we should say it's a very, particularly for that time, a sort of a feminist film. I mean, I think, like, you know, that would be the way to describe it, you know, certainly contemporaneously. It was a story about a woman who was sort of unabashedly seeing three guys, and it was, you know, that was the interesting thing about it. It was just a movie that took place within a black community, as opposed to a movie that was in and of itself. I don't know. I just remember Spike Lee saying, you know, because the criticism was like, you only put black people in your movie. And he goes, you never say anything about Woody Allen.
Yeah.
Like, Woody Allen does not put anybody but white people in his movies.
Spike Lee, to me, and I don't know how you feel about this, Sam, to me, Spike Lee is more the black Woody Allen than he is a resurgence of Melvin Van Peebles.
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. I mean, and there was, in my estimation, it was like, well, and for me at that time, too, what was really important to me was like the independent film aspect of it. Was like low budget filmmaking was the big thing, because video was just happening then. Like, I think at that time, like, it was, you know, Betamax and VHS had sort of like settled their wars, and you could buy a VHS-C camera, which was smaller than a normal VHS camera. And so like that was, and this is like in the mid-80s, late, you know, mid to late 80s, was happening. But yes, he was the black Woody Allen, without a doubt. I mean, you know, I don't want to, like, you know, diminish his thing by saying that, because I don't think he was necessarily derivative of Woody Allen, but he was analogous to.
He was more analogous to Woody Allen than he ever would be to, again, Melvin Van Peebles. And I'm not trying to put Melvin Van Peebles on any sort of pedestal. I'm just saying that Spike Lee never really went out there to be the black, filmmaker and show you the authentic black experience. He gets marketed as such because I think that's just the only way Hollywood knows how to market these things, right? They only know how to market us as race, right?
Right.
Pascal and I have a black show. Sure we do. Okay, we talk about black shit. Of course we do. But you talk about black shit too. You sometimes have more Negroes on your show than we have on ours.
Well, I mean, that'll happen occasionally, but we got to be on top of that. But yes, I think that's right.
What I mean. Yeah, it was all marketing, especially when you watch movies like She's Gotta Have It. And his next movie, School Days, is another super buppy, you know, black yuppie ass movie about black college life.
Yep.
where there's an in, where there's one interesting scene where the main characters are in a Kentucky Fried Chicken, a Sam Jackson scene, if you remember that, where they have this kind of back and forth with the local townies. And instead of kind of interrogating this dichotomy more, the main characters go back to trying to divest from South Africa because that's a bigger issue than, you know, poor people in the community in which you're exploiting. Like, yeah, the, whatever, those guys just don't know how to pick themselves up and get an education like us. So it's
I mean, there may have been some critique there too, because that was sort of like that was what was happening in that era, was like, you know, but it was, he was I guess it's like his agenda was more just telling personal stories on some level. And the Inkwell was also like that. Like the Inkwell was sucked. About, huh?
Inkwell sucked.
Well, yeah, no, but I'm saying like that was, he's doing a story of a black community in Oak Bluffs in Martha's Vineyard, which is like an old, a very old but wealthy community that has existed on that island for, I don't know, 150, 175 years,
but 200 remember years? What his first movie was? You're talking about Matty Rich. Remember his first movie is Straight Out of Brooklyn,
right?
Which I tried to watch. And look, before I even did this thing, a big reason why I wanted to do this thing was there was a conversation that Teray and Pascal and I had a few years ago about this, my idea of a second blaxploitation era in the 90s with all the hood films.
Right. Okay. Well, let's move into that. I mean, because,
And that's when you get stuff like Straight Out of Brooklyn with Matty Rich. Of course you get Boys in the Hood and all these movies that, double down on the Moynihan ideology of this ruined young black man, right? The defectiveness of young black males.
And we should say this is the Moynihan Commission that basically says that there is a, and he was a liberal-ish senator from New York who had determined that, like, there's a cultural, we have created a culture of poverty amongst black people that was sort of studious in its avoiding sort of like the political economic questions and sort of blaming it all on a culture, essentially. Which brings you all the way up to Barack Obama, like you're your brother's keeper type of plan, I think it was on some level. But this is coming out of that, we see films that capture that are more about not so much personal stories, although maybe in some instances some vague, you know, awareness, but more about trying to capture a fundamental problem that existed. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, look, I've seen Boys in the Hood more times than I can count. I went to the theater to go see it. And nothing is more of a commercial for the 94 crime bill than a movie like Boys in the Hood. And then the follow up Menace to Society.
And wasn't there also people were afraid to go to the theaters too? Was that one of those films where, but that was like in the news, right? Like people were afraid of violence at the theaters.
Yeah. People were fighting in the theaters. I mean, it just was what it was, and I'm not going to say those movies. I mean, the movie's message was always like, stop the violence, right? Except with Menace to Society. I always felt like there was no message in Menace to Society. But these are all fatherless young men that can't get right. And their only way out is by, you know, picking themselves up and probably going to school. And that becomes a kind of a genre of film for a while until you get to Belly, when it's just like the over embellishment of drug culture.
And so then
into that as well.
So we get into that era and then the pendulum swings back.
Ooh. So there's always these in between moments, right? Because there's two important things to remember. Hood films in the 90s also help out Hollywood in a down period. just like blaxploitation in the early 70s helped out Hollywood. So once you've helped out Hollywood, we don't need you anymore. But it felt to me like post-Hood films, we start to get quote-unquote black cinema. And the problem with blaxploitation, the problem with even the second wave with Spike Lee and the people that followed was it was always a depiction of the authentic black tale. What is that? Right? Some of them reminded me of my life, but not all of them.
Right.
A movie like Moonlight reminds me more of my life, even though I'm not homosexual, but there were parts in Moonlight where I was in tears. I was like, yep, that's happened to me before. You know, my mom was like that. But what is the authentic tale? And it's like, how do you tell an authentic tale of an entire people? That's just silly. But that becomes, you know, this is the authentic tale is Boys in the Hood. No, 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 it's not hard enough. Then you get Menace to Society. And then, well, that's not hard enough. And then you get some other derivative of that.
I mean, and nobody ever said Woody Allen is telling the authentic Jewish experience. It was always like he's talking about a specific subset of Jews in New York, which is a subset of Jews. Like, I mean, that, you know, and as Jewy as Woody Allen was in these movies, that's what you would get. I mean, nobody ever said, like, now we know the Jewish experience.
Yeah. But you know, for these black movies, that's what happens, right?
Right.
Black movies. So by the time you get to where I end the video essay is Wakanda Forever, because there was this, and also keep in mind the director of Black Panther is from, he's actually from where I'm from, Richmond, California. Ryan Coogler, probably a nice guy. Don't know him. I've seen Black Panther a few times. I'll probably watch it again. I'm going to see the sequel. I'm a sucker for Star Wars movies, superhero movies. I'm a little kid. I love sugar. I get it. I know what it is. But that doesn't mean I can't be critical of it. And the problem that I had with Wakanda was, first of all, it was Teray. I have to admit, Teray ruined it for me. We were talking about it, and he's like, man, I can't fuck with that movie. I'm like, why? He goes, you're going to tell me the most civilized, most technologically advanced country in the world got niggas with spears?
Yes. You made this point in the essay where you're like, they have the most technologically advanced technology and, you know, metal, and they're out there fighting on horseback and spears.
Like, they're riding animals and they got spears, and it's... But it's the only way people can envision Africa.
There's no way that Africa could progress outside of, like, the you know, they're in literally their own dome. And
they're in their own dome.
Like, almost unlimited resources and technology, and their progression is still has to be not just even, like, tribal, but, like, primitive. There has to be like a primitive, yeah.
Yes. It's a monarchy, but it becomes kind of almost this goal of what black excellence would be had it not been for colonization. I'm like, so you're saying that the excellence of black people would be a monarchy?
Right, right. I mean,
there's a royal bloodline?
Right.
Okay. You want to return to feudalism? That's what you want? But I found this clip. And it was of, and it was like, you know how when you're looking for stuff, Sam, and you find gold and you just want to call everybody up and be like, dude, you wouldn't believe what I found. I was so happy. It was 4 a.m. I was running around my apartment. I was this close to calling Teray, but I was like, I know he's probably awake, but the motherfucker won't answer the phone because this is so fucking perfect. This is exactly what we've been going back and forth on the phone about for like 6 months, right? Is this moment where these people get to tell the late Chadwick Boseman, you know, sad that he passed, was a really good actor, how much they care about his character. And what was funny to me is when people are comparing him to Obama, it really speaks to the haze that America was in with the first black president, and also kind of maybe a circumspection that we have with neoliberalism in this era, because Black Panther comes out about 2018, and this is great escapism. Here is all the good stuff that we thought we would have with Obama, right? With Black Panther, with Chadwick Boseman. He is our great leader. So what? He works with the CIA.
Right. Well, I mean, part of this also has to be seen, the way that it's received also has to be seen within the context of Trump, right? Because Trump is like, this isn't a shithole country. This is the most advanced country in the world. I mean, despite the fact that we still use spears. But this is... and we're still a monarchy, but I mean, this is the most, I mean, that, the, you know, so much of what was happening during the Trump era was a way to like psychically push back against Trump. And I feel like that's what that was on some level. I mean, like, you know, the movie, as far as those Marvel movies go, I think that was like one of the best ones because I can't stand that universe, but, but like it was like the best constructed movies of that ilk, as it were.
I mean, it really reaffirms a lot from the neoliberal era that we're kind of depressed from, which is, you know, we can work within the system to get what we want, but then what is it what you want, right? And when you're looking at these people in tears as they meet Chadwick Boseman, now keep in mind, they've projected upon him that he is the king of this mythical land. There's two mythical lands in Black America that I'll never understand why people love so much. That's Zamunda and Coming to America and Wakanda, right? And when I saw basketball players doing the Wakanda Forever, like LeBron was doing the Wakanda Forever thing, and there's a store in Oakland called Oaklandish, and they had hooked up with Marvel, and they had a whole line of Wakanda stuff because, you know, at the end of the movie, Chadwick Boseman's character comes in, and he's, like, going to fix low-income housing. And to kind of give you an idea of why this to me is a problem, there was a great article in the LA Times earlier this week about a company called Sola in Southern California that's building low-income housing at half the cost, getting done at half the time that it's taking companies that are going through state-funded projects, right? But there's labor rights violations they have left and right. There's all kind of tenants' rights violations they have left and right with people having roaches and rats in their buildings. They're not upkeeping the buildings properly. And when you're a privately owned company, you don't have to take in kind of the more hard to deal with.
Right. Tenants. The same thing with charter, you know, the same yes. dynamic with charter schools, like the way
it's
that
the
we
same
have
dynamic with charter schools. But when we don't tell that whole story and we show the Black Panther version, where he comes down in a magical, you know, Bentley.
Right.
And bestows upon the Negroids and Negronia low-income housing. Then people look to that as like the goal.
Right.
It's the doing good by doing good model is the goal. And we stop thinking collectively. And that's also kind of a theme in a lot of the things that I do is that there's a lot of hero worship that goes on. You know, you mentioned before we went on air that we don't need another hero video essay that I did, where I had actually ended with a clip from your sadly late co-host Michael Brooks that I thought was very important. That there's a frightening amount of hero worship that goes on right now in our culture, where even with people like Bernie Sanders, like, well, once we elect this guy,
right,
then we'll get there. AOC, once we elect this woman, then we'll get there. We don't need to have any movements behind them. Once we get them there, then we're there.
And, I mean, this is a
I don't know if this is a particular problem with our society on some level, but it is like the one where, you know, where you see it in the context of all the billionaires and the worship and like, oh, we're so lucky that Elon Musk is going to buy Twitter on the right. They're like, he's going to save us. I mean, it's all the same. Bill Gates is going to save education, or he's going to be in charge of the shots. And until, of course, it goes awry, and then he's really not in charge of the shots anymore. And I mean, all of this is, yes, it's highly problematic that, you know, relying on the largesse of like some philanthropy, because that's what it is. I mean, it's not like when a monarch decides to do something, it's basically philanthropy. And particularly,
do we want to rely on the whims of elected officials, or do we want to have collective power as a real left?
Well, yes, but I would also say, like, even this is not even an elected official. Right. Like, I mean, at least when it's an elected official who is decide, like, they can't operate with whims. The reason why the public housing, when we do it, takes so long is because, like, the people living there do have rights that are, yes, you know, not as efficiently as we want, are represented theoretically in the people that we elect, that you know, the workers building it has some, you know, stakes in investment, and supposedly, you know, at least the democratic ideal is there. If it's a philanthropist,
I'm going to find the cheapest way to do it. I'm going to find the fastest way to do it. I'm going to call it efficient, and I'm going to show you why your way is wrong. And what we're missing here is like a big reason why low income housing is about 600 grand per unit in California. A, you got to use union labor. That's going to cost more money. The first thing Spike Lee says in that clip, and the reason why I took, and Spike Lee is a boring interview in 1986. I had to watch a lot of shit Spike Lee interviews. Yeah. But I took that clip because when David Brenner asked him, oh, wow, you got the movie made for $175,000. How'd you do that? What's the first thing he says? Well, it was non-union.
Right.
And that becomes a theme in a lot of the Tyler Perry has a movie studio in Atlanta, non-union. So we don't really look at all the cost-cutting measures that these people do to get this stuff up. And then they don't have to have it up to code, and they don't have to care about it at a certain point.
Right.
And that's what's happening in Southern California with this landlord. He's the largest Section 8 landlord. He got social impact funds and went on a 5-year buying spree. And the mayor, former mayor Eric Garcetti, loves him. Oprah Winfrey loves him because he's doing good by doing good. Now, friend of mine, I hope you can have him on your show at some point, Randy Shaw, who actually does great work in San Francisco, runs two homeless hotels. Was able with his coalition, mostly of unhoused citizens in the Tenderloin area of San Francisco, push the mayor to give them the budget increase they need to actually do renovation work to their buildings.
It's funny because I was just back in my hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts, and heard a presentation from some CDC people, not the CDC Center for Disease Control, but the community development corporations, who do a very similar thing. They will get financing for tenants to basically buy their buildings and upgrade their buildings. And they do work with some private developers who then come in and add to the neighborhood, like, we're going to redo the laundromat and et cetera, et cetera. There are models for this that exist outside of what you're talking about. I'm going to send you actually a documentary. I got an interesting story about in Worcester, Massachusetts, a classic. We're going to tear down this mostly black working class neighborhood to create public housing. This is back in the 60s, 70s, when like the Moynihan sort of like thing was happening. And then we're going to make them pay to be in this public housing. Even though, I mean, it was just horrible, horrible. And the displacement and whatnot. But all right. Well, we got to wrap this up a little bit. But let's. Right. But at the end of the film, mm-hmm. you quote your co-host
yes.
on This Is Revolution yes. that. Well, there's two quotes. One is that black power becomes a sort of cultural victory versus a political one. Mm-hmm. And the other is that it proves like that the Kerner Commission was like they were successful in sort of pacifying their plan to pacify black political power was effective. The Kerner Commission, for people who don't know, was essentially LBJ's response to the riots that took place
over America,
all over the country. And but what was their? I'm not familiar with the commission enough to know what their plan to pacify black political power was.
I mean, Pascal kind of his piece. Was more on a man named Clarence Avant, and I won't get into that as we're trying to wrap up. That could be a whole other episode, and please feel free to bring him on, as he also loves talking to you as well, as you guys are also close in age. He does get no bullshit. He does love whenever you get to come on, because I'm too young for him to remember some shit, right? The Kerner Commission report is like, you know, we need to see more. They need to see more images of themselves. So after the Kerner Commission report comes out, you start to see more black newscasters, more black shows. Kind of you start seeing things like Soul Train, Good Times. All these shows start coming out. And that's kind of what you get. You get the cultural reproduction.
Right.
So the rise of these blaxploitation movies that just happen to happen around the same time is like the perfect windfall, right? Because you're like, as these cities are burning, that's why I started the whole, excuse me, I started the video essay off trying to show cities were burning and they were impoverished. These were the people that were left behind from the Great Migration. And as there were certain advancements with civil rights acts to get blacks entrenched in more trade unions, a lot of those jobs left. So there wasn't a lot there for people. And these are also people that are living on the government dime. So it's kind of this twofold problem. That's also why I put a clip of Reagan in there, because I really want people to understand the power of non-elected official Reagan going on a press tour, doing things like Carson on 30-minute segments, talking about the failure of public goods governance.
There was a lot of forces. There was a lot of like, I mean, the interesting thing was, is that on one hand, we see the rise of and the power of a cultural reflection of black people within the context of society, moving on up, the Jeffersons get to go up to the Upper East Side, and we start getting some black political leadership. We start getting black professionals, and that cultural power is. In lieu of political power, whereas Reagan is going around and using cultural power to leverage ultimately political power. And we have yet to sort of, and I think you need to have a certain amount of political power to leverage that cultural power.
But that's like the 72 Gary Convention, you know, and you guys could do a whole show on the 72 Gary Convention. I don't know if you guys ever get a chance to talk about that on your show, but that's where you get all these figures, black Marxists, black nationalists, black political figures, all arguing on what is the strategy. And ultimately what you get is what Pascal calls the fat back and biscuits governance, right? And so as you start to see more black people in elected positions in places like Gary, Indiana, or Detroit, or even Atlanta, some of these cities are really cash strapped because they were industrial strongholds where industry is leaving. So not all, but a lot of these black mayors are coming into kind of losing situations.
Right.
Getting elected because it's the black constituency that's getting them up there. Even cities like Compton, for example, in LA, because they had a big industrial sector at one point in time. By the early 70s rolled around, that industrial sector is gone, but you have a black political class. And what are they doing?
Well, they're set up in some respects to fail too, right? And then to the extent that then you get maybe governor of Michigan coming in and taking over and, using emergency powers type of situation, particularly when they're not quite failing and they're starting to build some political power, it seems to me. But all right, well, this is fascinating. People should check out all of your work. What's the YouTube channel that they can find it on?
This is Revolution Podcast, or YouTube.com. This is Revolution Podcast.
There you go. Jason, we got to do this again soon.
Hey, happy Father's Day.
Thank you very much. You too.
Happy Father's Day to Lionel Miles, my dad as well.
Appreciate it. Thanks. All right, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Peace.
Folks, looks like it's going to be a Freebie Friday today. We haven't had one of those in a while. So let's just get right into it. I just want to remind you, it is your support that makes this show possible. On every other day except for a Freebie Friday, not only do you get with your membership the fun half, the free half free of commercials, but also you get the fun half. And the fun half is fun. And today you'll get a little bit of taste of how fun it is for free because it's a Freebie Friday. Don't forget, support our sponsors and justcoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Enjoy that coffee, ladies and gentlemen. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
This weekend we got a Patreon conversation for folks. I talked with C. Derek Varn about him and his sort of time in the 2000s as a conservative and why he left conservatism. We talk a little bit about the current right and right populism. So it's about a 90-minute conversation, so a big one for our patrons, patreon.com/leftreckoning. And David and I are going to be on Left Flank Vets after today's show today. So this afternoon at 3:30 Eastern time, we'll be on Left Flank Vets and on their call-in show a little bit after that.
Well, now you know why they call it the Matt Lek Media Universe.
That's a lot of media going up.
Matt Lekian Media Universe, right? Did they say Matt Lek or Matt Lekian?
We'll have to consult the board on which we're going to go with there.
We're going to have to work on that. We're going to do Tulsi. Is that what you're telling me? You want to do Tulsi? Here is Tulsi Gabbard. They're getting big on this. Obviously, we have some of the highest gas prices in the history of, I think, in the history of the country. And let's be clear. We have had eras. What was it we said? 2008? When was this?
Oil was around the same price, nominal price, in 2008.
So 2008, barrels of oil, same price. But for some weird reason, the price of gas is significantly higher. 25-35% higher. That is because, and this is very simple to understand. In fact, it happened like with all sorts of businesses. During COVID, there was, and also during the era when we had cheaper oil, but really during COVID, the demand for gas diminished in this country. People weren't driving as much. They weren't going as many places. Oil refineries shrunk their capacity. Maybe they put a couple of like different refineries offline. Maybe they hired less people. But then demand for gas immediately went up. And as the gas goes up, the demand for it, they don't expand their capacity. They just charge more money for it because there is a greater demand and there's less of a supply because they're not refining as much.
Yeah, like when capitalists see greater demand, they don't think, oh, I'm going to work harder. They think, time to rake in money.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They're not going to invest in it. Now, this is also, to be clear, this is why like people say, like, we should be blowing up oil lines, or we should be making it more expensive. We should be taking, you know, if we make it more expensive for investors to invest in oil, fracking, whatever, they're not going to expand production and put money into it because they're not going to invest in it and it's going to shrink. Well, this is, we're in a period now where the refining capacity is low. And instead of increasing that capacity, because they don't want to increase the capacity, have things level out and realize like, oh, shoot, we're not making $50 per barrel of oil. We're only making $15 per barrel of oil now. They want to make more money and doing less. They want to increase their productivity, which is measured by how much work I put in versus how much money I extract from that work. And they're extracting more money. Their profits are record-breaking. And here's Tulsi Gabbard to tell you some other story that is fictional about this.
I would like America to go back to the Trump policies and secure our border. I would like to go back to the policies that America is energy independent and stop sucking up to Iran, Venezuela, OPEC, and Saudi Arabia. I would like lower taxes, not higher taxes, less bureaucracy, not more bureaucracy. Now, you're a Democrat, Tulsi. Do you disagree with any of my plans? What things I'd like to do?
We should have a conversation about each of those things, Sean. We probably agree on some, disagree on others. But
should we, all right, here's one. Should we enforce the laws at the border? Let's go through them by one.
Of course.
Okay, so we shouldn't have open borders. We should go back to the Trump policies. You'd be okay with that.
I've been very vocal about that open borders are a threat to our own homeland security. And with open borders, we don't really have a country.
Pause it for 1 second.
Now
pause
we
it
have
for 41
year,
let's be clear.
Year
let's
high
be,
of
be,
inflation.
Pause it,
and
pause it for 1 second. Let's be clear. We don't have open borders. There's no open borders.
Record detentions, in fact.
That's a fiction. That's a fiction. That's like, I want to say, I am against Santa Claus murdering people. I've come out many times. So Santa Claus should not be murdering people. We don't have open borders. But, well, let's play along with the premise because this is how I get on Fox. Go ahead.
Borders are a threat to our own homeland security. And with open borders, we don't really have a country.
Okay, now we have a 41-year high of inflation and record high gas prices. Now, we can finish the Keystone XL pipeline very quickly, and every day we'll get 900,000 barrels of Canadian oil right into the United States. Would you go forward with that, and would you lift the restrictions that Joe Biden put on ANWR and federal land leases for fracking and oil? Would you join me in that effort?
I'd look forward to a plan that ensures our energy security in a way that serves the interest of the American people and has done so responsibly.
Yeah, you're kind of ducking a little bit. I'm asking very specifically. Keystone Pipeline, you're in favor of?
Whether it's the Keystone Pipeline or other resources that we have available here in our country,
okay, you would support opening
energy
ANWR?
Security. And done so in a way that's responsible and not contaminating water as some of the fracking has done in certain parts of the country.
Would you remove the restrictions and regulations that Joe Biden put on the energy sector? And that means allowing more leases to be given to oil and gas companies on federal lands. That would finish the Keystone XL pipeline, reopen ANWR, and allow these companies to do what they do best, and that's produce the lifeblood of the world's economy. Would you support me in that effort?
I support you and agree with you in energy security. I don't know specifically chapter and verse all the regulations and restrictions.
Okay, now let me just interrupt here because this is like so painful to watch. She's so desperate not to correct Hannity here. But also, she's obviously looking to maintain some environmental credibility because she's going to run for something in the future. I don't know what it is she's going to run, but that's what's going on here. If she was honest, she would say the Keystone XL pipeline is going to run through this country and that it's going to be sold on the world market. It has absolutely nothing to do with energy independence whatsoever. The fracking, the drilling, all of the supply, completely irrelevant. Again, we saw these prices for oil per barrel in 2008, but gas prices were 25, 30% lower because this is a refusal of the refiners to expand their capacity. There is no restriction that is inhibiting them from expanding their capacity. Now, personally, I just want to make this clear, I would nationalize the refineries. I would nationalize all the oil production. I would have your charging stations. I would have electric cars, all of this. She could say any of these things, but she won't because that position to get onto Hannity's program is so desperately desired by her for whatever reason that all of the good that she thinks she's going to do, I'm giving her the benefit of the doubt, goes out the window when she allows him to, A, both propagate this complete fiction of what energy independence means. It means nothing. What he's saying is gobbledygook. And also makes her look evasive because she can't say anything. She can't actually say, Sean, what you're saying is complete stupid. It's
the permits
moronic.
Thing is ridiculous. We all know there's more permits out there than they've been used.
So. Of course. Their leases, they've got so many leases they're sitting on. Why are they doing that? Because the way they choke the demand, the supply on the refinery level, with demand being like this, and they know demand is going to probably even out, by choking supply, they get to charge more money. So for every gallon, they have the same amount of people working on it. They have the same amount of electricity involved in refining it, but they get more money.
Yeah. Do you want them to hire more people to raise that sort of capacity that they're just going to have to fire later?
No. Exactly.
And like, this is speculative, but it almost feels like Hannity knows the power imbalance here, right? Like, he's, when he was kind of like, oh, you're skirting around it a little bit, I feel like he's kind of like, you can't really disagree with this.
This is
you want to come back on
I don't
shit.
Know how much he knows or not. He's an idiot.
Yeah, too, I guess
so
you're right.
It's
it could
hard
be a little
to
bit.
Assess that. I've talked to that guy in person.
And he actually is a dope.
I mean, he just reads talking points and he's good at like hammering people on them, but maybe that's part of the game. And part of it may be just like, you know, this is the value for him is to say you're a Democrat. They put
exactly. It's just that charade. Like, look at us having this simulated.
They put a D behind her name. They don't put R's behind, the name of like former Republicans. Of course not. But they do that there because this is his Alan Combs. But go. Oh, that's the whole clip. Oh, there it is. OK, well, there you go. I mean, she knows. She knows.
It's just like the simulated, yeah, like Combs. This is a simulated debate. Right. People, it sucks that people watch it and be like, oh, wow, look at Hannity taking to this Democrat.
Both sides.
Is just like a crypto Republican.
Yep. There it is. What should we play next? What was this one here I wanted to do? Oh, yeah, here's the SCOTUS leak. Let's talk about this. I don't know when we're going to get the who did the SCOTUS leak. But here's my prediction. If they ever come up with who it was, and I think that is a very good chance we're never going to know. Because I think when they find the result, we won't know. But if they come up and they find that it was a liberal justice's clerk, or someone who is considered to the left or whatever, somebody working in the print room leaked it, which it was not. We're going to hear about it very soon. if they find out that it was someone from Alito's clerkship or a conservative, and they're, you know, when they find the person, they're going to say, this is a conservative. But we'll find out. We'll get a sense afterwards if we find out who it is. They're going to do it well after the ruling on Roe v. Wade comes out. Because Roberts wants to punish Alito for leaking this because he knows that's why it was done, in my estimation. But he doesn't want to get on the wrong side of the conservative movement. And he doesn't want, because if it is the case that this was released by, leaked by a right winger, and we know there were right wing leaks to the Wall Street Journal that predated it. It wasn't information. It was information. It wasn't a document that was leaked to the Wall Street Journal. We know this happened in 2012 too, in the ACA case when they were going after Roberts. If it is that case, it is going to be one more illustration for the American public that the Supreme Court, if the people in the majority of the ruling did this, it's going to mean what the verdict that the Supreme Court imposes on the country is unjust. And it's going to make people understand that institutionally, this is very, very problematic institution. But in the meantime, if you're on Fox, you don't have to deal with any of this reality.
And where is the leak investigation? How hard is that? You round up the clerks and you waterboard them.
Oh, Jesse.
You take their phones and you waterboard them. Theoretically, you waterboard their brains with tough questions. Everybody knows I'm kidding. This is what's going to happen next week. The Supreme Court's going to release this opinion, and they're probably going to be gone by then. They'll probably be in their houses in Maine on the coast or at some lake house in Minnesota.
Okay, so there it is. I mean, they're making it as if like there's something nefarious going on. Like, why is this? And it really is. I'm convinced. If we ever get we find out, it's going to be well after the verdict because they don't. If it was from the left, if it was from the losing side, what better timing would it be to release it just before the verdict or the ruling, I should say? But if it's from the right, they will release it much after the ruling because it will undercut the legitimacy of that ruling.
Pretty sick culture, too, to just do, like, waterboarding jokes.
It's a twofer. It's a twofer. Can't trust government or to get anything right and to do things efficiently. And also, it is like, you know, torture is Club Gitmo.
Hilarious.
Yep.
Dana Perino's faux out. Jesse.
Whoa. Oh, please. You know, I was a big part of that administration that actually ran the torture program.
Don't Google me.
We don't in any way make light of torture because it was a serious tool to keep America safe. Which one's this?
It's where he calls Elon an African-American.
Oh, I missed this one. Oh, yeah, and then I do want to do 12. And 11 and 12, actually. Okay. Here is Ron DeSantis. Is Elon Musk, has he moved down to Florida with Dave Rubin?
He's in Texas.
Oh, he's in Texas, though, right.
So he had an interview, Sean Hannity was interviewing Mayra Flores, the woman who won that special election in Texas, and apparently Elon said he voted for her in that primary. So I guess he is in Texas.
And Elon has said that he supports, if he had to vote for president now, he would vote for Ron DeSantis. Now, everyone knows that Elon Musk comes from South Africa. Is that it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if people fully appreciate the history of South Africa.
It's a shame if they don't.
But it strikes me as possible that people don't realize that up until 20 some odd years ago, right? 20, I don't know.
To the 90s? I don't know. Yeah, it's pretty young. 20,
yeah. 25 or so years ago, maybe more, close to 30 years ago now, I guess. A white minority controlled every aspect of the government in South Africa and essentially subjugated all of the black Africans there, these Afrikaners, they were called. And Ron DeSantis, this dude is a real king of trolling.
Elon, so what I would say, you know, I'm focused on 2022, but with Elon Musk, what I would say is, you know, I welcome support.
Wait, what's going
on? Sorry, let me go back. I think we missed the
question. Okay. Yeah. Here is the question that he gets asked about Elon Musk at a press conference.
Governor Elon Musk said this morning that he would vote for you if you were to run for president.
Elon Musk. So what I would say, you know, I'm focused on 2022, but with Elon Musk, what I would say is, you know, I welcome support from African Americans. What can I say?
Yeah, there you go.
I mean, this is a right-wing meme in defense of Elon Musk that you see an awful lot. And it's not a surprise given Christina Pusha, who's Ron DeSantis' sort of meme edgelord spokesperson, that this is sort of culture he'd be engaging in. But I mean, I do just want to point out that... back when Elon was going to buy Twitter, the New York Times, I believe,
Still back on it now. He's back
on
Twitter.
He was in all
Twitter,
hands, right?
Yeah.
In that meeting.
So the New York Times had an article that said, like, Elon Musk grew up in apartheid South Africa, you know, sort of insulated from the actual, like, you know, reality of his living situation. And so he doesn't really understand, like, free speech and misinformation. Like, he was a product of, like, anti-black culture. And
right.
You can really actually see that when you look at what his Fremont factory is being sued for. I mean, the one that I'll say on mic is they had an area where black people do the hardest work that they called the plantation. There's other things that I don't even want to say, have my voice put to. But and his mom said that, like, what are you going to judge people based on where they're from? Well, if their behavior sort of shows a sort of through line, then yeah, I think it's fair enough to say, like, that's he's apartheid Clyde, as people are calling Elon Musk.
Yeah, I mean, the idea of aggrievement is, you know, not everybody who is white in South Africa growing up at that time or now or then necessarily fits this bill. But there needs to be a very, very, very vigorous and healthy dose, unhealthy dose of aggrievement to be able to believe that you are just in essentially ruling a country and subjugating a whole group of people, particularly by race, who are in the majority. There needs to be a huge amount of aggrievement, which is no coincidence why the conservative movement in this country needs to feel incredibly aggrieved to be able to justify to themselves the democratic nature of having multiple presidents who did not win the majority of the votes, to have state houses that are controlled by Republicans that did not win the majority of the votes, to have a Supreme Court that is dominated by conservatives, despite the fact that it was appointed by presidents who did not have the majority of the votes, and in some instances actually sort of like broke the rules. They're just rules. They're not laws, but they broke the rules. Well, we had to do that. We had to do that. So, I don't know. It's also interesting to watch Ron DeSantis in his, like, sort of method acting. Here. Arms go from here to here. You can see that he has been practicing Trump's moves.
Oh, yeah.
Back and forth. The guy is built his whole career now to be Trump, whose name is not Trump. He's pulling Steve Scalise. Steve Scalise famously said upon entering, I can't remember what kind of a VFW hall or something it was, like, who's that KKK guy?
I'm David Duke
without the baggage.
Exactly right.
DeSantis, I'm Donald Trump without the baggage.
Is Trump a normal guy? Normal politician. Last election cycle was, we want the businessman. Now we just want a normal politician. Here's a Vic Berger video about how DeSantis is...
looks like Trump. Here we go. All right, let's do that a different time. All right, we got a couple more of these I want to do. Here's Ted Cruz on with Michael Knowles. And I will tell you something. We are back to where we were in the early 2000s, where the Republican Party, and we've said this many times, all the grooming stories, they'll say trans or they'll say, they'll say transvestites or they'll say transgender. But make no mistake about it. They are revisiting the homophobia of those early 2000s. They don't, somebody who's transphobic is not, they don't perceive themselves as, well, I'm not homophobic, but I'm transphobic. I don't like transvestites, but I do. I don't like, they don't make these distinctions. They get freaked out by anything that does not fit the theocratic God Squad version of the way that genders and family roles should be. That's it. End of story. And they may be aware that I can't say we should outlaw men having sex or being in love with men, or we should outlaw women having sex or being in love with women. They can't say that now. But if they felt they could, they would. This is exactly the same exact talk that they were deploying with gay people 16 years ago, 18 years ago. I mean, prior to that too, but that's when it was its electoral heyday, I think. Here is Ted Cruz and Michael Knowles.
Well, I got to say, Michael, I think it is remarkable that the Verdict podcast seems to be driving Hollywood's agenda. You and I sat at the University of Alabama for our live campus tour, and we were talking about woke Disney, and I observed, I said, look, these lunatics, they want to see Mickey and Pluto going at it. And the press lost their mind. Wow. And then what do? Boom, the next movie they come out, Buzz Lightyear. What do we need? We need lesbian toys. Now, never mind that the last time I checked, most toys are kind of androgynous. They're usually without genitalia unless you're
a little
shopping
flat
in
the, yeah.
Yeah, like it's just, but it is the commitment to
pause
culture.
Pause it for one second. I'm just going to, Ken and Barbie.
That's what we're talking about.
I mean, Ken and Barbie. Yes. I don't think that these characters in this animated film have genitalia. But Ken and Barbie had some pretty serious gender roles.
They're coming out with a Barbie live action movie.
Ken and Barbie were explicitly heterosexual.
Absolutely.
And if heterosexuality was viewed anywhere near the way that these two clowns view homosexuality, they would have been outraged. Talk about grooming. But he needs to make this premise like this is new. It's not new. None of this is new. None of this.
This is, they figured, they put the like homophobic bigots on the bench after the mid-2000s stuff didn't go so well. And now they're just found a way to play them again.
Yep, that's it.
Usually without genitalia unless you're
a little
shopping in the, yeah. Yeah, like it's just. But it is the commitment to culture is, and you know, this movie has now been banned, I think, in 14 countries. The UAE has banned it. There are countries in the Middle East. There are countries in Asia. There's significant discussion that China is not going to allow the movie in because of this scene. And I got to say, it's a wild twist where Hollywood has been willing to grovel to China, to let China censor its movies, to embrace anti-Americanism, to avoid any criticism of China because they want to get access to the Chinese movie market. But when it comes to their culture agenda, apparently now suddenly they've discovered, all right, give up the money because lesbian toys are more important. And I must say it brings a whole new meaning to the phrase to infinity and beyond. Yeah, that's sort of like the slippery slope, Senator. You know,
pause it for one second. I really enjoy Michael Knowles fake laughing because it what? Let's just work backwards. It brings a whole new meaning to the phrase "to infinity and beyond."
Like, what does infinity or beyond in this circumstance mean? But what are the terms?
It doesn't bring any new meaning to the words "infinity and beyond." What's fascinating is you just watched in real time Ted Cruz realize like how he effed up in his talking points. And then had to reel it back in. So he's like, they've already had it banned in 14 countries. And then we realized, like, oh, shit.
It's all the countries I like to.
I should not be naming these countries because I have, like, disparaged them over and over again. And the one thing that we find grotesque about them is that they are authoritarian or theocratic. So let me make this about the hypocrisy that... That Hollywood is willing to make anti-American films, like, and then he's got to go to infinity beyond and poor John Knowles or whatever, Mike Knowles has to pretend like it's funny. And he's probably just admiring like, oh, he almost got in trouble there with his, is there more here? Let's continue.
Covered. All right. Give up the money because lesbian toys are more important. And I must say it brings a whole new meaning to the phrase to infinity and beyond. Yeah, that's sort of like the slippery slope, Senator. You know, it seems that we never get to the bottom of the slippery slope. Maybe that's because the slippery slope goes to infinity and beyond.
Oh my gosh. That is
good Lord.
God, so painful.
It's so funny though to like, yeah, he's like, it's been banned in so many countries because of how egregious this lesbianism is, like United Arab Emirates and China and all these anti-American countries. Like, what are you talking about? Yeah, they banned it because they're like religious theocrats. It's the exact same reason you want to.
In Iran, they banned this film because of the lesbianism. It must be, it's fascinating. These guys, they are, and again, he's talking about lesbians. Like, you know, do you remember there was that book, was it Michael Signorelli who wrote this book that was called, like, It's Not Over or something to that effect? I think we had him on a couple years ago about it.
It's Not Over, Getting Beyond Tolerance, Defeating Homophobia, and...
And I remember when he came out that book, like, half of the, like, he had to be defensive about it on some level. Like, guys, we're not past this yet. And a lot of people were like, come on, man, it's resolved. What are you trying to tell me that we're going to see a Republican senator, number two in the presidential race, come out and malign Hollywood because there's lesbians in the movie? Seriously? No way. That is so 2010.
Or like drag, like just like the concept of drag being like an animating cultural.
Rudy Giuliani would dress in drag.
Yeah, right.
I mean, at events.
Exactly. Like,
Raw Story, I haven't seen this kiss that people are upset about, but according to Raw Story, although many reports have focused on a supposed lesbian kiss in the film, the scene in question is actually more of a brief peck between two long-married characters who have a child.
I mean, it doesn't even matter what it is, as much as they know that this is going to generate electoral benefit for them. And this is, we are back to where we were in the aughts. It's like a Benjamin Button type of situation. not quite back at 2004 where George Bush got up in prime time and said, it's with a heavy heart that I need to say that we are going to seek a constitutional amendment to prevent gay people from marrying. Also, sort of a tacit understanding that maybe the Constitution says that gay people can get married. We need to amend that to inhibit their rights, to create second-class citizens. We need to change our Constitution to create second-class citizens. We've seen the Constitution interpreted in such a way that we have second-class citizens, but I don't know if there's ever been an attempt to rewrite the Constitution, to add to the Constitution, to create a class of second-class citizens, an explicit one. That's where we were in 2004, and we're working our way back. Speaking of right-wing bigotry, Megyn Kelly still out there kicking around, Fox, NBC, now to Newsmax, last vestige. On with Eric Bolling. And yes, they are still talking about Fox News' weekend story on a family, Christian conservative family, who acknowledged that their child was trans, who have allowed this child to identify as a boy, though he was born as a girl, and the outrage that this would appear on Fox. It's fascinating. In some ways, it's really fascinating.
The problem is the Fox News Channel mission is not to do reports that sound like MSNBC, right? The Fox News Channel mission is to make sure that they include the context that gets ignored by all of the other stations. And in 2022 in particular, we know that there's a lot more to this story. And it is irresponsible to put it on the air like this as a celebration without flagging for the parents out there who are going through this, the significant downsides of jumping onto this without making sure you're in that very, very small percentage of cases where this gender dysphoria might actually be a thing. And the trope of I'd rather have a dead, daughter than a live son or the other way around. And it's like, that's a very dangerous trope because this is used by the LGBTQ activists to shame parents who know about that 70% statistic that generally, if I stay out of it, my kid's going to outgrow this. And in many cases, they just turn out to be gay. It's like this is a weird form of conversion therapy by default. And so to not flag the significant downsides of what happens to these kids when they're put on puberty blockers, when they're put on cross-gender hormones. By the way, when that's done to girls, they're sterile. They can't have children anymore. And you could go down the list. Is irresponsible to their mission. I mean, I don't expect any of the mainstream press to do it. I really don't. And although they should. In 2022, we know enough that they should.
Well, you know,
but I am surprised to see
So, in other words, these transgender activists have the ability to shame doctors and parents into it's of course it's hugely widespread. That's why we have like an infinitesimally small number of trans kids. To the extent that you could say that they're trans, they're identifying. I guess they are trans in the sense that that is the way that they feel. But in terms of like getting procedures. And yes, the puberty blockers, as if it's just being handed out, like it's, you go into the candy store and just grab them. And of course it's like, and then she frames it as like, this is a way to protect gay identity, which of course we just played a clip of Senator Ted Cruz complaining about lesbians, gay identity existing in cartoons, that they exist in culture. I mean, this is the two-step. This is the two-step.
Yeah, trans kids are just actually gay. They're just gay. They don't need to go any farther. Like, it's just such a tortured way to get around like homophobia. Being like, oh, I'm all supportive of people just being gay, but trans goes too far. Like, and it
we don't want the government to get in between a patient and their doctor when it comes to just providing a means in which to pay for their doctor. But we're willing to get in between a patient and their doctor when it comes to saying we can't have puberty blockers.
Yeah.
We don't want the government to get in between essentially like parents and their children insofar as like if the parents say the children's are going to work at age 12, they're going to work at age 12, right? I mean, they also want to roll back child. That's what child labor laws are about. Parents are going to want to exploit their kids for money, but we are okay with having the government presumably interfere in the relationship between the parents and the kids when it comes to the parents who in no way, I mean, I'm sure there are some parents maybe who are like, it's completely, we were hoping for a trans child. But in this context of this country with this level of bigotry, very hard to imagine. There are parents out there who are like, I'm hoping my child is trans. Because this is definitely going to be something, it's going to be an easy road for them.
Yeah, and there's a pattern. It's a willy-nilly thing that people are just going out and giving their kids puberty blockers.
Right.
It's just like there's a willy-nilly thing between people getting an abortion right before the baby's about to be born. And it's all this, do not trust people. The government and people are degenerate, and the government should guard against that.
It's almost as if the people have sinned. They have done the original sin, and unless they repent.
They need penance, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is all fundamentalist religion being imposed upon us. And that's why when Ted Cruz was complaining about it, he lists off a bunch of fundamentalist theocratic countries, short of, I guess, China in terms of an authoritarian regime. So, all right, let's... Los Tacos says, it's worth noting that the high rate of kids turning out not to be trans that Megyn Kelly is saying is not about kids who necessarily thought they were trans, but instead was about kids who exhibit gender nonconforming behavior who don't end up being trans.
That seems like a big distinction.
It is a big distinction.
It's despicable. I mean,
Affluence Wretchedness says also the media isn't doing anything about this. New York Times published 4 anti-trans articles in the past month. Vatov says Ted Cruz talking about imaginary toys genitalia just ruined my childhood. All right, let's read some IMs and then we're out of here. BT from Connecticut, from it, I don't know. It would absolutely make my day if you all watched even a bit of Benny Johnson's The Left Can't Meme. Oy. Pinko's Bastard. Seems like the Uvalde news cycle is over and nothing will be done. I propose $20,000 handout to all high school grads or GED recipients. It would cost us $80 billion a year, 8 months of Ukraine killing. This would be a huge incentive for finishing school and a huge bump to people essentially to enter the workforce. It's already means tested. We are the Armed Services Committee is asking for $45 billion above and beyond what the Biden administration is asking for. It's absurd. It's insane. J.B. Davis, these Jan 6 hearings are great drama, but like Shakespeare said, to paraphrase, we are but actors who strut and fret and are on an hour upon the stage, and when we are finished, leave not a rack behind. The committee said it will not refer charges, and the Republican Garland has already shown he will not charge the honorable gentleman of Congress or past administration. Bipartisan Joe needs to get a Femocrat AG. Democrat. Damn autocorrect. Good Shabbat. Jacob from Alabama. Any other MR listeners at the Labor Notes Convention? Would love to say hi. Tell them to holler at me at JacobM_AL on Twitter.com. If you're at the Labor Notes Convention, reach out to Jacob from Alabama. Nick in Japan, this message I got from my mom gives me insight on where the right-wing media is covering the hearings. Where's the defense in these January 6th trials? Aren't they going to allow Trump due process to defend himself? This trial seems biased. Starfox. Sam, your hatred of Granny Smith is well known. How do you feel about Crispins? No, Crispins are pretty good. pretty good. Nolan from Detroit suburb. Hey, I'm our crew. In 2018, Michigan, there was a ballot initiative to move control of redistricting from the legislature to an independent commission. So I was trying to look up to see who will be on my ballot for district. I noticed a huge change in how the districts are drawn. Before the change, District 14 would go from a part in Detroit through Southfield and into Pontiac, and those cities have a higher concentration of black people compared to surrounding areas. My new District 11 is not nearly as crazy before. The previous one just looked like our legislature wanted to throw all the black people in one district. They did. Also, friendly reminder that Michigan primary is on August 2nd. We have an open primary. Colin from Maryland. Do you have any insight into the Maryland governor's race? I don't. The Dem primary seems to be pretty close. The Republican side is basically Hogan versus Trump with Scholz and Cox. I don't have any insight to it. I'm sorry. We'll look into it. It's a fine time. Grab her by the pence. We were saying that a little bit earlier. Dave from Jamaica. People would pay more attention if there were consequences. But since we know no one with power is going to jail, it becomes meh. Good point. Rotting in the peg. Should we be fighting for a democracy that has failed us? The system works for Cheney. Dems need to acknowledge the systemic failures of our democracy. Indeed. One of the Koch brothers got no paid leave for having a COVID, and they told me to come if I don't have a fever or it'll count against me. Damn, I love Walmart. Jesus. Should let the media know that. Milton Apathy, are you blaming Democrats because they haven't handled this well, in your opinion? But, dude, they knew all the Republicans were going to try this just like all the Republicans knew. The Democrats have to know we're on the precipice already. What is the political value when there aren't enough Republicans who don't believe in democracy? Maybe 10 senators in the GOP even care. They put this all in motion in 2000. They broke the seal. I agree. J-Man Raps. Just wanted to warn Emma that Sam may be thinking about coming for you after Monday's episode where you showed positive energy and vibes. We know these boomer freaks are obsessed with life extension technology, and they may be able to harness energy's level of younger people to do just that. Be careful, Emma. Well, a little late. Sorry, she's not here. She'll never hear that. Bangway. Dumb little anecdote. In 07-08, I worked at a gas station, personally got blamed for high gas prices. People thought I was jacking up the prices on my own. I was 19. When it comes to gas, average people tend to blame everyone but the oil companies. Nationalize that shit. I agree. All right, three more. Margo from Mass. Laugh my ass off. We don't need lesbian toys, and so does Cruz's wife. We do need a lesbian toys, and so does Cruz's wife. Poopy Dipey. If oil companies don't expand production, do we ever run into a potential gas shortage? If the decreased production meets demand forever, why ever expand it and just put a price control on it until we phase it out? It's not so much production, it's refining. It's the refining that's going on. But yes, price controls. Without a doubt. There's been rumors. The Biden administration talked about this like a week or two ago. They floated it.
You should have to get clearance to raise prices.
Yes. Just like energy prices. Honestly. There should be a regulatory commission. You need to prove to us that this is actually, I mean, there should be a frickin', you cannot say this is a national security issue. You cannot say it's a national security issue to have American energy independence and then not say refiners, you get this percentage of profit. Period. End of story. Just like we do with the energy company that comes into your house. Like, why is it any less relevant when it comes to cars? Ladies and gentlemen, the final I am of the week. Sam, congressional districts question. Is it possible for there to be an equitable proportional representation system without districts? I ask because of an intense frustration I have felt with both computer-generated districts as well as human-drawn districts. It feels like at this point it would just be easier to remove the thing that is being exploited and figure out some other way to decide who represents us. I mean, I suppose, but it would be rather, like, complicated. If you do an at-large type of thing, it's a problem. Have districts. Have them done by independent commissions. There are academics, we've talked about this in the past when it came in front of the Supreme Court, where you have a threshold of what is known as wasted votes, where you cannot exceed a certain threshold so that
districts remain competitive, but you're not essentially concentrating certain voting blocks. With that said, Matt, Bradley, great job this week. See you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my